You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk Nation Radio, John Bolton appointed National Security, so-called security advisor. Our guest is Mitchell Plitnik. Mitchell Plitnik is former vice president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. He is the former director of the U.S. Office of B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, and was previously the Director of Education and Policy for Jewish Voice for Peace. He's published an article called John Bolton, The Essential Profile. Mitchell Plitnik, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Well, it's great to be here.
Thanks for coming on. Just briefly, my perspective, the past few weeks here, it goes from bad to worse to even worse. Pompeo worse than Tillerson, Haspel worse than Pompeo, Bolton worse than Haspel. Do I have this right? Is there sort of a level beyond in John Bolton?
Absolutely. For a couple of reasons. First of all, just who he is, but I think more importantly, with Bolton, it's his position as National Security Advisor. That is a place where he can really, really do some damage. And you see with Pompeo, for example, he, assuming he's confirmed, which I'm hoping is not a sure thing, he can't do anywhere near the damage that other secretaries of state have been able to do, because the president won't support him if he doesn't agree with him. That doesn't happen with the National Security Advisor, because the National Security Advisor's only role is to shape what the president himself does. And John Bolton is just the wrong guy to be speaking to Donald Trump and advising him on what to do.
And so you actually are describing it as a more powerful, more dangerous position, but it's the position that Congress doesn't get any say over. How did that come about?
The reason is that it is an advisory position to the president. So in essence, the National Security Advisor he's not a secretary of a department or part of one of the main cabinet positions that you have in the executive branch, the Justice Department, the Treasury, et cetera, the Department of Education. It's really a bureaucratic issue where this is supposed to be somebody who the president picks as someone who is going to give him good advice and help him develop sound policy. That is the idea. That's the idea behind the position, so it's not supposed to be subject to the political whims of Congress. This is part and parcel, I think, of what we're learning about and what we're experiencing in the Trump administration in general, which is that, if there's a good president, that setup for the NSA is a wise idea if you have a responsible president. And that doesn't necessarily mean the president whose policies we always, speaking in a sense as progressives or liberals, would always agree with, but at least somebody who's competent and, going to make sound decisions based on rational judgment. Then it can be sensible. Maybe people don't like it, but it's something you can live with, because when a president more to your liking gets in there, it's a good thing for him to have the right advisors that he wants or she wants to have next to him or her. In this case, obviously, the downside is exactly what I described before. It really how bad that is, I think, depends on who the president is.
Yeah, our best hope may be that Bolton is so abrasive that he gets in a big argument with Trump, because otherwise Trump is going to be listening to whatever Bolton says.
Well, I think I think there's actually there. I think you kind of touched on it here, but he won't argue with Trump, and I think that's one of the reasons that he was picked. I think that he is smart enough to recognize that that Trump is somebody who can be manipulated, but who, if he's confronted, does not like that. I think Tillerson and McMaster, you know, who in any other administration, I think anybody on the even on the in the center, certainly on the left, anyone considers themselves a progressive or liberal, would have despised these men. They were supposedly the hope. They were the adults in the room. I think one of the reasons is they argued with Trump. They disagreed with him. They tried to pull him into different policy positions. Bolton won't do that. The hope, however, lies in the fact that Bolton has a tendency to really upset everyone else. He'll kiss up to his boss while making life miserable for those under him and around him. And that can turn into a problem. So hopefully that sort of thing surfaces quickly, becomes a major problem, and Trump feels like he needs to get rid of it.
Yeah,
I don't know how likely that is, but that is, I think, certainly one hope.
Well, Bolton certainly has a reputation for not being a nice guy personally, but in terms of public policy, he's also a disaster, and your article does a great job of going through. We hardly have time for all the wars and catastrophes that, that John Bolton has been part of creating or trying to create, but he was ambassador to the United Nations, an institution that he would as soon see abolished, right?
Absolutely, and I think, you know, that was, as probably most people listening to this know, he was not going to be confirmed for that position by the Senate. And that was a Republican-controlled Senate at the time with a, obviously, Republican President George W. Bush. His confirmation hearings were going down in flames. And that, there was just no way that Bush was going to get him through the Senate. So he made a recess appointment, which got Bolton a little over a year in the role ambassador, and I think he really went with Bush's message of complete disdain for multilateralism, complete disdain for the opinions of the international community. In fact, I think Bolton, I would say Bolton was along with Dick Cheney, the primary drivers of that that sort of ideology for whatever else we might say about the father, Bush, George H.W. Bush, that was not his way. He believed in building alliances, as we saw in the first Gulf War, not necessarily for, the right purposes, but he did believe in working with other countries. George W. Bush's administration was, we're going to do what we want to do, and if you feel like coming along, that's great. And Bolton was the perfect messenger for that. In the United Nations, and I think Bolton is the man most responsible, maybe even more than Cheney, for the isolation that Barack Obama came in trying to address in 2009, the isolation that George W. Bush left this country with.
And Bolton is one of these characters, correct me if I'm wrong, who loves bombing places in the name of protecting the Constitution which says that treaties are the supreme law of the land, but thinks that treaties aren't worth the paper they're written on.
Yeah, treaties are political symbolism to Bolton. To Bolton, Bolton looks at it, and this actually differentiates Bolton from the neocons. He's not a neoconservative. He's more radical than the neoconservatives who led us into, who he worked with to lead us into the invasion of Iraq. But he's more radical than them. Those guys believed in quote unquote democracy promotion. Now, what they really meant was bringing the American system and forcing basically other countries into that same system so that in the end it all works for the United States. But Bolton doesn't care about any of that. He doesn't care about that ideology. He cares only about what he sees as American interests and whatever the United States needs to do, in his view, it should do because it's strong enough to do that. It has the most military strength, you know, the biggest economy, and so we should do what we want to promote our interests. I don't think he even considers whether that's good or bad for the rest of the world. I don't think that matters to him. So, anything that we agree with, any ways that we compromise with other countries then, are not things that meet John Bolton's criteria. So he believes in solving diplomatic problems militarily. Unless we can get everything we want through diplomacy, I think he would probably say, "Yeah, sure. If we can, if we can get North Korea to unilaterally disarm without actually firing a shot, great." But this I would agree with. And probably doesn't think that's possible. So, at least not without actual compromise. Most things, clearly, if you're going to get an agreement, you have to give the other side something to make it worth their while to agree. And he does not believe in doing that because we have this option of just bombing the hell out of people, and that'll get done what he wants to get done, or so he thinks. I mean, he has clearly learned nothing from Iraq. He is absolutely unapologetic about that war. He believes that it was a success. He thinks everything that was done was correct, and whatever bad things have come of it have come because both the Bush and later the Obama administration didn't handle it properly.
Right.
So yeah, this guy just believes in solving problems with guns and bombs.
Which doesn't work. We're speaking with Mitchell Plitnick, whose article is called John Bolton, The Essential Profile. We'll have a link to it at talknationradio.org. We should be clear that in the past, treaties have been negotiated with North Korea. North Korea has agreed to disarm without being bombed again, and has made clear in recent years and decades what it would take in terms of ceasing to threaten it for it to go forward with such steps again. So it's having somebody like John Bolton in the White House that's going to create this notion that you can either bomb North Korea or do nothing, as if there aren't other alternatives, right?
Right. I mean, I think that's true. I think, there have been agreements between the United States and North Korea, which, in my opinion, and I don't know that I would say that it's necessarily a majority opinion, but in my opinion, those agreements were initially signed in good faith, and both sides did various things that undermined them over a long period of time. But clearly, the idea of a military strike on North Korea is just horrifying in the amount of bloodshed you're talking about. Just within hours of it to get, you would be seeing an enormous exchange of weaponry in densely populated areas. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of deaths within hours, let alone what would follow in weeks and months after that, because as we saw in Iraq, these things don't just end with an initial strike, no matter how many times you want to repeat the phrase is now mission accomplished. Sorry.
Yeah.
No matter how many times you want to repeat that, the mission was not accomplished, and war is never that clean and simple.
We're talking about
an enormous amount of bloodshed that Bolton and others who want to strike North Korea don't care about, and there are alternatives. There's clearly a diplomatic alternative. Whether or not that means that North Korea would disarm, it would certainly help bring North Korea into a less confrontational stance. And, I think one thing that's particularly dangerous with Trump about North Korea is that there is no short-term solution to the issue with North Korea. They have crossed the nuclear threshold. They know that that's something that keeps them safe from attack. So any way that they're going to be convinced to roll back their nuclear program, the only way that's going to happen is after years of building trust and building up relationships. It's going to take a long time, and that is not the Trump style. Patience is not his virtue.
And it seems a little slight bit, at least, more horrifying than ever before, at least adds insult to injury, in that John Bolton has published a column not only advocating for bombing North Korea, but declaring such an act to be legal, in gross violation of the UN Charter, the Kellogg-Briand Pact. There's nothing, correct me if I'm wrong, there's nothing that actually makes it legal to go and bomb another country.
Absolutely not. First of all, the entire concept of the preemptive strike is essentially illegal unless the Security Council can be made to unanimously, the five members have to be unanimous at least, and the rest of the council has to vote with that a preemptive strike is truly self-defense. So unless there's some way that you can establish in front of the Security Council that with a pretty high degree of certainty that North Korea is about to launch a massive attack on, say, the South, there is absolutely no way to justify. And that, incidentally, would only justify South Korea attacking them, not the United States. So, the idea that a first strike against North Korea is in any way legal is patently absurd. But I think, to shift the view slightly, I think North Korea, as dangerous as that situation is, and as much as it's in the headlines, I don't think that's the real danger. Well, it is a let me not play that down. It is a very, very real danger, but it's not the biggest one. I think Iran is a much bigger concern with John Bolton.
You go into that topic and numerous others. We will not have time for every danger or every war. But the topic of Iran, John Bolton, as you describe in your article, has an organization that's put out a nuclear scare ad, a TV ad in the United States, suggesting that Iran, which has no nuclear weapons, would use one on the United States. And he's advocated, at least for Israel, to use one on Iran. This is beyond we must overthrow a government, we must start a new war. This is advocacy for nuclear war through lies about nuclear scare.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the advocacy for nuclear war is probably a little overstated in the sense that I don't think he seriously believes that he can convince any president, even this one, to do that. But not with a country that does not have nuclear capability, as even Trump knows they don't. So I think there's that. But an attack on Iran, and a massive one, is not out of the question with John Bolton. And indeed, I think he is working towards getting us there quickly. Trump is, as we all know, Trump is dead set against the Iran nuclear deal. Bolton's obviously going to help him tear it up. So that'll be the first step. And unlike with North Korea, with North Korea, one major difference is that our close ally in that region, which is South Korea, is going to do everything in its power to stop the United States from attacking the North. Because they're the ones that are going to be retaliated against.
Right.
They know that, and they also know that there's no need to attack the North. They're not under, there's a tense situation there that's existed, for well over half a century, but they know that they're not under imminent threat from the North. So unless the North really feels like it's going to be attacked. So they're going to do everything in their power to stop Trump. On the Iran side, and I think this makes a very, very big difference to someone like Trump, he is our allies in the region, our main allies, Israel and Saudi Arabia, absolutely want Trump to attack Iran. And have been pushing. They were pushing Barack Obama to do it. They were pushing George W. Bush to do it. They are pushing Trump to do it. And Bolton is absolutely on their side, which is really something new. That differentiates him certainly from Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, certainly from H.R. McMaster, from Rex Tillerson. These guys are all out. Pompeo is less passionate about it than Bolton, but he's probably going to agree with him that we should attack Iran. That is now who's talking to Trump. That is who's whispering in his ear. And I think the deadliest thing with Bolton, and this is true in every regard that we think about in terms of foreign policy, whether it's Israel, whether it's Iran, whether it's North Korea, Russia, etc., Bolton has two things that make him extraordinarily dangerous. One is that he has worked in government since the Reagan era. He knows how this stuff works. He's not Rex Tillerson. He's not H.R. McMaster. He's not Michael Flynn. He's somebody who really knows the ins and outs of how to make things happen. He knows the steps that need to be taken. He knows the things that can be done that don't necessarily raise all the red alerts among the public to set up a war. He's done it before, and he'll do it again if he can. The second thing that makes Bolton so very dangerous is that we know that he was a maybe the key person in fabricating evidence that got us into Iraq. And the way he fabricated it was he didn't make stuff up. He creatively omitted things that, you know, that never made it into various reports. Or he put into reports things that were speculative, that weren't conclusively proven, that he liked. Basically, Bolton is an expert at taking the a mountain of evidence and forming out of that, picking and choosing to form out of that the picture that he wants to see and that he wants to present. I cannot imagine a president more susceptible to something like that than Donald Trump. This guy is easily swayed. We've seen this in so many different ways, whether it's the NRA, Saudi Arabia, you know, whoever. We know that if he's flattered and then given a picture that he doesn't know how to critically examine, which is most things, because he's so inexperienced, he is very, very easily pushed, especially if it's being pushed in the direction he already wants to go. So, I mean, that is why Bolton is so dangerous in every foreign policy regard, but especially Iran.
It seems like
the openings for that are all there.
It seems like Bolton stands out as rather rare in that he still to this day declares attacking Iraq in 2003 to have been a very good thing, whereas even Trump campaigned against it. Even Hillary Clinton pretends it was some sort of minor glitch, mess up, you know. But it seems like the reason such a person is still in public life at all is that the public and even the elites have turned against that particular war in a dramatic way compared to every other war that's just as immoral and illegal, and yet no consequences for anybody, no prosecutions, no impeachments, no shame, no truth and reconciliation, just oops, let's move on. I mean, would John Bolton still be in public life if there had been any sort of accountability for such an unpopular action?
Well, I think especially the point of fabricating evidence and you know, basically dreaming up the narrative that Colin Powell, at least to my eyes, seemed to be reluctantly delivering at the United Nations all those years ago. If there had been an investigation into that, I can't imagine that some of that would not have been criminal. So I think, you know, you would at least have had a major scandal. That being said, we had that with the Iran-Contra deal in the 80s, and yet someone like Elliot Abrams is still around, and still his voice still weighs heavily in foreign policy discussions here in Washington. But yes, I do think that this is why so many of us were basically shouting to Barack Obama to investigate and to expose what happened here, not to just say, okay, it was a mistake, let's move on, which became the narrative for many. I think, as you pointed out correctly, you know, Hillary Clinton being one, so it's not just a Republican thing. The sense was, oh, we made a mistake, we're really sorry, and gee, what can we do now but just move on with our lives, which is nonsense. That's not what happened. It wasn't a mistake. It was a crime. It was done intentionally. The question is, which of the people involved were fully intentional? Which of them were maybe somewhat deceived? And that should have been investigated. And yes, that would blunt Bolton's position now, except his acceptance on Fox News, I think, would have been just as strong, which in turn probably means that Trump still could have appointed him. I mean, not many people like this appointment as it is.
No.
So, on both sides of the aisle, I think Republicans are particularly uncomfortable with it because it's one more difficult thing that they're going to have to defend.
But But if Bolton had been to prison, that couldn't have hurt in terms of his chances of getting more jobs. And the people who were deceived should perhaps be sent to live at some pleasant campground and not be a danger to themselves anymore. But we have just a few minutes left. Mitchell Plitnik, I want to ask about in terms of this question of accountability, Bolton was key in sort of undoing the International Criminal Court and building pressure against ever using it against anyone in the United States. I mean, was that was unsigning that Clinton signed treaty? Was that his idea or George W. Bush's idea? I mean, who was the mover behind that?
That is pure Bolton. Now, having said that, certainly I believe that both Bush and Cheney were completely behind the idea, but it was Bolton who spearheaded that whole campaign. Bolton, and again, this is part and parcel of who Bolton is and his agenda, which is that he believes the United States should not be held accountable. He believes the United States is the ultimate authority. And the only reason he believes that is because he believes the United States correctly believes the United States is the most powerful military on the face of the earth. So that part, the ICC part, is absolutely him.
Yeah.
And it moots the power of the ICC all over the world. Most of the world still is party to the ICC, but without the United States, any real accountability that any international tribunal can hold is kind of weak.
Just a minute or so left, not to get people even more horrified, but this guy, John Bolton, ultimately, he wants to be president himself, does he not?
He does. I don't think that's a realistic hope. There are certainly the Mercer family, for instance, loves him. So there are certainly those who would support him. But I think on the whole, he would have a very hard time. One of the things that got Trump a lot of the Republican support that he got was, ironically, that he campaigned as an isolationist. That America was going to pull back from its involvement in the rest of the world. Bolton's the exact opposite. He's not a multilateralist. He's not what Trump calls a globalist because he doesn't want to work with anyone else, but he absolutely wants to be involved with the rest of the world. Trump talked about how we're not going to waste all this money again on wars and et cetera, and now he's turned around and brought in people who are going to do that in ways that are geometrically huger than anything we've seen before.
I wish we could go on. We're running out of time. I think Trump said both. He said more military spending, bomb the bleep out of them, kill their families, as well as no overthrows and so forth. So it's a dangerous time. This is an incredible article you all should go and read. John Bolton, The Essential Profile by Mitchell Plitnik. We'll have a link up at talknationradio.org. Mitchell Plitnik, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me. It was great being here.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the administration that has announced and acted on its intention to root out, harass, and deport black and brown non-citizens wants to add the question, are you a U.S. citizen, to the census. The list of problems with that is long. We'll discuss some of the key ones with democracy reform activist Karen Hobart Flynn, president of Common Cause. Also on the show, as the U.S. government ramped up for war in the wake of September 11th, 2001, TV screens were filled with what seemed a parade of generals. Military men became the sources of first resort over, and indeed against, regional experts, historians, and peace advocates. FAIR founder Jeff Cohen witnessed that parade firsthand, working in cable news. We caught up with him recently to discuss his current case of déjà vu. We'll talk about lessons unlearned with Jeff Cohen, associate professor of journalism and director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. He's also author of the book Cable News Confidential. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press. You may have seen the Arabia Foundation, or its founder, Ali Shahabi, in the media lately. Shahabi was on MSNBC's Morning Joe March 20th, running through what happened to be a number of talking points from de facto Saudi ruler Mohammed bin Salman. The big one is that the crown prince of U.S. ally Saudi Arabia is engaged in a massive corruption crackdown. Well, a recent New York Times investigation noted that the Saudi government won't specify any charges against individuals or say who's been found guilty or innocent, and, quote, extensive interviews with Saudi officials, members of the royal family, and relatives, advisors, and associates of the detainees revealed a murkier, coercive operation marked by cases of physical abuse, which transferred billions of dollars in private wealth to the crown prince's control, close quote. None of that came up on Morning Joe, which moved from bin Salman's corruption crackdown to how he's modernizing Saudi Arabia and taking on the religious establishment. Shahabi also had an op-ed in the Washington Post, scapegoating Saudi Arabia won't help us fight terrorism. And he was seen on BBC World News and CNN, touting bin Salman's change-making credentials while serving as an independent analyst of Saudi Arabia and U.S.-Saudi relations. It would be fair to wonder if the Arabia Foundation and Shahabi have ties to the Saudi government, but these appearances, including Morning Joe, where he talked about the country's need for a benevolent autocrat, wouldn't tell you. FAIR analyst Adam Johnson made multiple requests to the foundation for its donors, but they wouldn't provide any other than founder Ali Shahabi himself, an investment banker. They say they're not backed by the Saudi government, but by private citizens. Now, the distinction between private citizens and the government in a hereditary monarchy is somewhat blurry, but Johnson found one connection worth noting. The registered agent and legal counsel of the Arabia Foundation, Eric Lewis, represented the Saudi government and related charities in the lawsuit brought by families of September 11th victims over the Saudi royal family's role in the September 11th attacks. The website of Lewis's law firm boasts that it has, quote, extensive experience representing and advising foreign sovereigns, including the governments of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Egypt, close quote. Indeed, Washington Post columnist Ishan Tharoor has noted the foundation has close ties to the kingdom. It just doesn't stop the Washington Post opinion section from running multiple op-eds from folks on the foundation payroll that identify the group simply as a Washington-based think tank. CNN and the BBC didn't mention any relationship either. So when Shahabi says, as he did on Morning Joe, that the proof that bin Salman's bold, needed leadership is approved by the general public is that there's been, quote, no bloodshed, there's been no demonstration, no domestic strife, close quote. Well, viewers not only hear no one mention that when there were anti-government demonstrations in 2011, the Saudi military opened fire on protesters and snuffed out resistance with torture and extrajudicial killings, but no one asks whether Shahabi's group's ties to the Saudi regime affect its assessment that the Crown Prince is widely loved and popular. Pentagon grapples with a thorny question after Niger ambush, read the March 19th Washington Post headline, What Next in Africa? But as Gunnar Olson wrote for FAIR.org, among the possible answers not considered by the Washington Post, close U.S. military bases, end U.S. drone strikes, stop U.S. special forces raids. Post National Security reporter Dan LaMoth reported that the four U.S. Green Berets killed in Niger last October, quote, did not have air support for an hour after calling for help, leaving it vulnerable as a larger force of about 50 militants attacked with rifles and machine guns, close quote. According to the Post, the ambush, quote, underscores the danger of dispersing small teams across a vast continent, where the Pentagon does not have the same level of support for its service members as it does in a country such as Iraq or Afghanistan, close quote, where U.S. forces, quote, have a more robust network of fire support, aerial surveillance, medical help, and quick reaction rescue units when a crisis erupts, close quote. Other reports, like one by NBC News, noted that U.S. service members deployed to Niger weren't eligible for the imminent danger pay available to their counterparts in Iraq and Afghanistan and other, what it called, dangerous environments. By juxtaposing the U.S. military presence in hot battlefields like Iraq and Afghanistan with its role in places like Niger, sometimes referred to as being outside of areas of active hostilities, Olson notes, media make the implied answer to the question, what next in Africa, seem to be something like expand U.S. military infrastructure to protect and support U.S. special forces who will inevitably engage in hostilities. Underscoring that in the Post story is a quote from former AFRICOM commander Carter Ham, who says, quote, sometimes the knee-jerk reaction when something bad happens of get them out of there, that's not a particularly good response, close quote. What exactly is wrong with that response? The Post doesn't ask. The upshot is that not only the U.S.'s benevolent aims on the African continent, but the strategic value of endless war are not questioned meaningfully. A research fellow from the Cato Institute gets the last word in the piece, and he questions the definition of the mission. Quote, is it building up indigenous forces? And is that the extent of it? If so, great. Or are we doing kill-capture missions? Because if we're doing kill-capture missions, the horror of war is that you'll always kill the wrong guy in some numbers, close quote. That the U.S. military should not be intervening in sovereign African nations to kill-capture, to change regimes, to extract resources, to arm forces, to fight other forces, well, that's not a perspective allowed admission into the conversation. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. How much impact could the addition of a single question to the U.S. Census have? So much that 12 states are suing the Trump administration to counter the move. The question in question is, are you a U.S. citizen? It might raise eyebrows coming from any White House, but coming from this one, the last-minute move raises tremendous concerns that only begin with the likelihood that the question would depress response. Karen Hobart Flynn is a longtime democracy reform activist and the president of Common Cause. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Karen Hobart Flynn.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what are the big concerns about adding a question about citizenship to the census?
You know, Americans' founders created the census and wrote into the Constitution a requirement that their successors need to count all the nation's inhabitants every 10 years, because they understood that for a truly representative democracy, we must know how many of us there are in the country and the states in which we live. So inhabitants, not citizens, was the requirement. So people are alarmed when they see, for the first time since 1950, that this administration wants to put a citizenship question in the census without any kind of testing. And in an atmosphere where we have seen this administration with its anti-immigrant rhetoric and long list of anti-immigrant policies and proposals, many that have been struck down by judges, it's created a tidal wave of fear and concern that any information they provide to the census, although it's supposed to be kept private, could be used to deport family members and neighbors.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, in another context, I might have started with a sort of rhetorical, you know, what's the big deal? You know, but I think it's just so obvious in this case what the big deal potentially is. It's wholly appropriate, isn't it, to see this in the context of other moves by the administration. Why wouldn't respondents have concerns about confidentiality when this administration has said explicitly, you know, we're looking to root out non-citizens, you know?
Right.
You know, well, but then, of course, going on from that, if you undercount, what happens?
There are many impacts that go to both the heart of our democratic system and also how that data is used by communities. For instance, that information is used by communities to decide if they need a new fire station. It has an impact on schools, resources in a community to deal with assistance for veterans, hospitals, transportation. And so the impacts are large. And then when it comes to our democracy, you know, democracy means everyone counts and has equal and fair representation. So one, it's important to ensure every person is counted accurately so that they have fair political representation. This data that they collect is used by states to draw district lines, and those district lines determine how many seats a state will have in the House of Representatives, and also the maps drawn for state legislative districts. We already see some real challenges and the politicization of drawing maps that occurs every 10 years, where incumbents like to select their voters rather than the other way around. But this actually rigs the system before we even get to the part of redistricting. And so that's one of the biggest challenges. And it's interesting because the Census Bureau has really tried for the last several decades to remove that kind of politicization and to work to make sure that they can get the best count they can. Back in 2010, the Census Bureau worked with community organizations to do outreach, to let people know that the information that they collect is kept private and that nothing bad will happen to them if they comply and answer the census data. This move, I think, is going to really undermine that.
It trashes that trust that's been built up. Well, Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross presented it as a kind of just a dry, sober, statistical matter. It has something to do with protecting voters, you know, enforcing the Voting Rights Act. It's a little too Orwellian, almost even too engaged. But what I really wanted to say is, at the same time, the Trump reelection campaign is fundraising off this possible change to the census, making it clear that it really does have something to do with what one of the former directors of the census, Kenneth Pruitt, said. It's a step toward not counting the people you don't want to count.
That's right. Two things. One, this notion that the Voting Rights Act's enforcement is needed using census data has been debunked by Eric Holder, our former attorney general. He, as attorney general, and his predecessors never needed to get citizenship question on the census because they could use the data derived from the existing census process to use for any voting rights litigation. And actually, the Voting Rights Act, it was enacted in 1965, and the census hasn't included a citizenship question since 1950. So to suggest that now this administration is concerned about enforcement of the Voting Rights Act, you know, really is laughable.
Doesn't pass the sniff test. And then to that point about not counting the people you don't want. And this is coming from a former director of the census. You know, six former directors of the census have written this letter saying this is a bad move, that it will dampen turnout. But then Pruitt goes on to say, no, I we can actually see a strategy here. And it's an anti-democratic strategy.
That's right. There's going to be more litigation besides the 12 states. I saw the NAACP is suing. We know California has already sued. So I expect that there are going to be many court challenges. And I'm not sure what that's going to mean for the timing of this. You know, usually if there are new questions, this is brought up early in the process. It's thoroughly vetted. Congress is involved in that process, and this is a very last-minute addition with no testing, and that's why it raises even greater concerns.
Well, and that was going to be my final question, is what do you see happening? It sounds like a lot of lawsuits. Is there any way for folks to weigh in, or do we just kind of, you know, watch what happens?
I do think that it is important for citizens to let their elected officials know that a citizenship question is a bad decision for the census, for our communities, and for America. And they should be urging their members of Congress to weigh in against this citizenship question. And I also think that we will also see more litigation around this matter. So I don't think this is going to be a settled matter anytime soon.
And I should have asked you if you had any thoughts on media. Frankly, what media I've seen in the last few days has been pretty explanatory and has critics have been represented, you know, critics of this move. But are there angles of the issue you'd like to see journalists dig into or explore more?
I do think, and I've seen some of this, but pushback on the White House assertion that this is pro forma, that these questions have been asked for years. There is a more detailed long form that goes to one in, I think, 38 people that ask questions about citizenship. But for the bulk of the census, the people that participate in the census, they are not questioned. So to suggest that they're just doing something that's always been done, that isn't true. So I think continuing pushback, because we see the Trump administration have, you know, the Fox News and others repeat what they say from the White House press room, I think it's important to continue to push back on those errors.
We've been speaking with Karen Hobert Flynn, president of Common Cause. You can follow their work online at commoncause.org. And her article, Ensure Everyone is Counted, co-authored with former Census Bureau Director Vincent Baraba, is on U.S. News & World Report's website, usnews.com. Karen Hobert Flynn, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Everybody got it wrong, is the dominant corporate media refrain on the war on Iraq. Officials had intelligence that no one could have suspected was flawed. Reporters were swayed by persuasive government evidence, and alas, it went awry. The clear-eyed remember that not everyone got it wrong. There were plenty of people who said the Iraq invasion, besides being illegal, besides being based on deceit, would be a human rights, political, and ecological disaster. Those people just weren't on television. Who was? An endless round robin of retired military and intelligence officials, with reporters fawning over them rather than challenging them. As Cokie Roberts, then of ABC News' This Week, put it to David Letterman, quote, "I am, I will just confess to you, a total sucker for the guys who stand up with all the ribbons on and stuff, and they say it's true, and I'm ready to believe it." Close quote. It's hard to picture a TV journalist making such a statement today. Or is it? We're joined now in studio by Jeff Cohen. He's Associate Professor of Journalism and Director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. He's also co-founder of the group Roots Action, author of Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media, and the founder of FAIR. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jeff Cohen.
Great to be with you.
Well, it's strange times to be a media critic. You know, for years being a leftist media critic meant pointing to the structural biases of ownership and sponsorship of media, and then to the kind of institutional biases of the hangover of McCarthyism and just the sexism and racism that all U.S. institutions are part of to some degree, but with journalism then having that sort of patina of objectivity. But now where we're in this kind of all hands on deck against Trump mode, it seems like if you criticize the New York Times, you're seen as counter-revolutionary?
Even more so if you criticize MSNBC or CNN, you're seen as somehow disloyal to the cause of deposing Trump.
Well, so start with MSNBC, where you once worked, and which I think many people still think of as kind of a counterpart or opposite number to Fox. What's going on there?
I wish. It is not the left-wing version of the right-wing Fox. I was watching Fox all the last few days, and when they attack Trump, it's always from the right. It's always from the grassroots. It's always, he's not right-wing enough. He's not conservative enough. He sold us out on this or that. I mean, generally, they're pro-Trump. On MSNBC, on their other hand, and you could see it throughout 2015 and 2016, if anything, in the battle between Clinton and Bernie Sanders, they tilted toward Hillary Clinton. They're more with the corporate hawk wing of the Democratic Party. So, Janine, to get to your specific point about today, if you watch MSNBC, the people that are put forward as their experts, the saviors, the people that are going to save us for Trump, are in many ways a collection of war hawks, spooks, spies, dishonest people who progressives have traditionally attacked. I mean, our heroes are supposed to be Mueller and Comey, who headed the FBI when many progressive groups were surveilled. We know that, what happened under their reign. For years and years, those two headed the FBI. If you watch MSNBC, you see people like Chris Hayes interviewing Barry McCaffrey because McCaffrey's anti-Trump. And by the way, I saw Chris Hayes interviewing Barry McCaffrey on the week that we marked the 15th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. If there was a voice on television that was more pro, let's invade Iraq, let's invade them tomorrow, it was General Barry McCaffrey on NBC and MSNBC. So I'm hoping when I see, wow, McCaffrey's on with Chris Hayes, that maybe Chris Hayes is going to ask him to explain how he was so wrong about the need to invade Iraq, and does he feel he owes an apology? Instead, because McCaffrey's critical of Trump, I guess McCaffrey's now our hero. So you could go one by one from MSNBC to CNN, where they have Mr. Clapper, James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, when he went before the U.S. Senate and he perjured himself and said the NSA is engaging in no bulk surveillance. He's the hero on CNN. And so you find this collection of perjurers and war criminals, because they're critical of Trump, they're put forward on MSNBC and CNN. And remember, those are supposed to be the liberal cable news channels. They're put forward as some sort of heroes. They're going to save the republic, save progressives, save democracy. I just don't see it. And it shows, I think, the limits. You brought up the ownership. It shows the limits of TV news channels owned by Comcast, in the case of MSNBC, where they almost never bring up net neutrality, the saving of which is probably the main First Amendment issue facing our country and progressives, and then CNN owned by Time Warner.
It's so disheartening, this idea that the enemy of your enemy must be your friend, that we can't be any more politically complicated than that, you know? And then also just that the best source is always going to be the guy with medals and gray hair, you know, even if he's the same person that lied to your face years before, you know, that somehow as a source or as an expert, there's no one who deserves that spot more than they do.
It's a closed system. It's a narrow system. What FAIR has talked about for decades is we have a corporate spectrum. It goes from General Electric to General Motors. It goes from hawk to dove. But the doves are hawks, and the hawks are super hawks. So you have this narrow spectrum, and if you don't fit in to that narrow spectrum, you don't get heard. And as you say, there are many effective critics of Trump, many people who could make a strong argument about why he should be impeached. Believe me, the strongest argument about why he should be impeached has got nothing to do with Russia. I'm part of a group, RootsAction.org, and we started an impeachment campaign against Trump on day one of his administration. And it was about corporate conflicts of interest. He refused to divest himself from his sprawling business interests, unlike Jimmy Carter, who divested from his peanut farm when he became the president in the 1970s. And it's a clear violation of the emoluments clauses of the Constitution. If you want a progressive critique of Donald Trump and why he should be deposed, you've got to go to independent media. The corporate media, MSNBC and CNN, will just give you the same parade. You know, I was in cable news, as you know. I wrote the book Cable News Confidential about my years there. And I was there at the beginning of the war on terror, and there was this parade of all these war hawks telling us why we needed to invade this country or that, how successful it was going to be. And everything they said turned out to be nonsense. And those people are back on the air.
Well, any final thoughts while we have you here?
You may think that James Clapper, of the formerly head of intelligence, and General Barry McCaffrey and McLaughlin and Brennan, these former vile CIA chiefs, that they're your allies. They are not your allies. These corporate media conglomerates need to be battled by progressives. The military-industrial surveillance complex needs to be battled by progressives. They're not our allies if we want a more just society.
We've been speaking with FAIR's founder, Jeff Cohen. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch group based in New York. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Thank you.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock with the highs, lows, blows, and no-go zones. Climate change is heating up on the other side of the world, you know, in the places your news ignores, unless you live there. We'll hear about heat already beyond the Paris safe lines in India, another punishing summer in Australia, and record hot times in Tasmania and New Zealand. We've got Dr. Larry Shoup explaining the Billionaire Club, the Council on Foreign Relations, and their role in dialing down climate action, plus a teaser talk from deep greener Derek Jensen. Industrial civilization is killing us, he says. The future may be low on fun, but there are flickers of resistance. Here is reporting from the UK Independent, headlined, Anti-Pipeline Campaigners Found Not Guilty by Judge Because Protest Against Climate Change Crisis Was Legal Necessity. Here is the lead from that article in the Independent, March 28th. More than a dozen protesters who clambered into holes dug for a high-pressure gas pipeline said they had been found not responsible by a judge after hearing them argue their actions to try and stop climate change were a legal necessity. Karina Gore, the daughter of former Vice President Al Gore, was among more than 198 people who were arrested because of their 2015 actions protesting the pipeline in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, a neighborhood of Boston. 13 people were to go to trial this week, though prosecutors downgraded their original criminal charges to one of civil infraction. That was from the Independent newspaper in Britain. Here's a quick clip of Karina Gore after winning the lawsuit with a climate defense.
Hi, I'm Karina Gore, and I'm with the Center for Earth Ethics at Union Theological Seminary. I was very proud to be a part of this action and this movement here against the West Roxbury Lateral Pipeline, which is part of a whole system of pipelines, a fossil fuel build-out at a time when we're already experiencing climate impacts, when we know that putting more of this pollution into the air is going to cause serious harm and death and suffering for people on the other side of the world and for our own future generations. What happened today was really important. We had a long and winding road, but essentially the people that put themselves in the way of building this fossil fuel pipeline were found not responsible by reason of necessity. And the irony of that is that we are making ourselves responsible. We are part of the movement that's standing up and saying we won't let this go by on our watch. We won't act like nothing's wrong. We're going to be speaking up in new ways. We're going to be demanding that the people who are in elected office and also the corporations who are putting their costs, the cost of their doing business for their own profits, they are putting that cost on the public. They're putting that cost on future generations. And we are taking responsibility to say no to that.
The pipeline battle continues on the west coast of Canada. The Coast Salish tribe of First Nations people are leading a charge of thousands protesting doubling a pipeline from the dirty tar sands in Alberta to the port of Vancouver. Mega tankers would sail through the precious waters between the mainland and Vancouver Island. Here is an update emailed by Atiyah Jafar of 350.org. Quote, it all started on March 10th when 10,000 people marched in solidarity with Coast Salish spiritual leaders who simultaneously built a watch house, a structure used by their people for generations to watch over enemies, on the path of the Kinder Morgan pipeline on Burnaby Mountain. From March 17th to 24th, 172 people were arrested at the gates of the Kinder Morgan facility on Burnaby Mountain. These courageous action takers included Indigenous activists, youth, retirees, and many others. There were some high-profile participants as well, Indigenous actress and activist Carmen Moore, the leader of the Green Party of Canada, Elizabeth May, and NDP MP Kennedy Stewart. May and Stewart become the first ever sitting MPs to be arrested in solidarity with the Indigenous fight for climate justice. That was a report from 350.org. Learn more at protecttheinlet.ca.
I really wanted to be here to support the people that are taking the bold step of crossing over the injunction line.
It affects us all, obviously, but it's especially important to the Indigenous peoples, and it's important to stand with them.
We need to be on the front lines, putting our bodies on the line before they do.
Sites and areas referred to in this being collectively as Trans Mountain Sites.
Climate action is going backwards at the same time in America. The Washington Post reports March 28th that staff at the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, have been given talking points playing down human role in climate change. I'll read this from the Washington Post. The list offered suggestions on ways to talk with local communities and Native American tribes about how to adapt to extreme weather, rising seas, and other environmental challenges. Employees crafted the email, first disclosed Wednesday by the Huffington Post, on the basis of controversial and scientifically unsound statements that EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt has made about the current state of climate research. Human activity impacts our changing climate in some manner, reads one of the talking points. The ability to measure with precision the degree and extent of that impact and what to do about it are subject to continuing debate and dialogue. Another states that while there has been extensive research and numerous reports on climate change, clear gaps remain, including our understanding of the role of human activity and what we can do about it. That was from the Washington Post article by Brady Dennis and Juliet Elpern, describing what the EPA has been told to say to the public. Here is the way it looks from
the other side of the world.
Where the United States, which is historically the largest climate polluter, has pulled out of the Paris Agreement. And its president, Mr. Donald Trump, is legislating anti-climate and pro-fossil fuel policies, which will see huge increase in greenhouse gas emissions in the US. This is indeed a scary situation. A polluting United States means bad news to the world, and more so to India and other developing countries, simply because a vast majority of people are poor in our part of the world, and they are vulnerable to the impacts of climate change.
But hey, if your homes are flooded and burned out in America, don't worry. The Federal Emergency Management Agency now officially doesn't think climate change is real. Bloomberg's Richard Gonzalez has the headline, FEMA drops climate change from its strategic plan. As Bloomberg reports, quote, similarly, under a section about emerging threats, the document cites cybersecurity and terrorism. There are no references to global warming, rising sea levels, extreme weather events, or any other term related to the potential impact of rising surface temperatures. End quote from Bloomberg. I guess all the science we report here on Radio EcoShock is just fake news or a witch hunt. But let's talk about
the other side of the world.
The other half of the world. As it turns out, even when it's cold and snowy in real places like New York, Oslo, or Moscow, there is a different part of the globe where it's, like, really hot. Global heating never stops. Meanwhile, we have new reporting on the Tasmanian Sea between Australia and New Zealand. By the way, Tasmania itself has had the hottest winter from November to January ever. Funny that. New Zealand just had the hottest winter it's ever seen.
A scorching summer for some, but it's also been deadly. High temperatures claiming the life of a woman in Christchurch this week. For many, this hot spell is a big concern. Recent fires in Wanaka and Queenstown may be just a taste of what's to come.
You know, we're forecast for a really extreme day on Wednesday. You know, it gets to a situation where we won't have enough resource to deal with if we get multiple fires like that.
There have been more than 90 serious fires in the south since Christmas. And while there's a total fire ban in the region, some people aren't listening. And for farmers down south, this dry, hot weather brings with it a long-term cost. This paddock is supposed to be full of crops, and even this tiny patch is damaged.
So pastures, we've had a loss of a lot of the spring sown stuff this year, so that's going to be an added cost in the next couple of years.
That was from New Zealand's Channel 1, January 25th, 2018. The Tasman sea surface temperature was exceptionally high, more than about 2 degrees above average for December and part of January. That is going to have impacts on sea life that we may never know, but kelp forests and abalone have been hard hit, we know that. In an article published March 27th by the Australian ABC News Network, climatologist Dr. Blair Trewin said, "These temperatures were far above any others previously observed at that time of year in the region, and extended west from New Zealand to Tasmania and mainland southeast Australia," end quote. Australia had a super hot winter, too. To get the feeling, even beyond the sweltering Australian Open tennis match, I'm going to do something unusual for this show. I'm going to play you part of a YouTube video uploaded by a user in Australia by J. May Stojanovic. It was on January 19th, 2018, as his mother went through a power outage with the temperature at 113 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 45 degrees C, in the shade. Jay May is not a reporter or an expert. I'm playing this because she, in her very human way, hits all the news you need when the heat wave gets to you.
It was actually, I just found out on the weather officially, it was 113 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 45 degrees Celsius. So if you can imagine, like, that's, we were in air conditioning, which most people have here because it's Australia, it gets boiling, you know, and we've got a huge hole in the ozone layer over us. So we were all just sitting, watching a movie, and next minute, that everything's, all the electricity's gone out. And I'm not joking, probably within, I reckon, about 10 minutes, it was just, we all started to, like, get boiling. And sweat was just pouring down our faces. And we have a neighbour, our next door neighbour, Ricardo, he's from South America. He's 98, and we had to check on him. He was absolutely boiling. So he said that he was going to go and lay in a cold bath, because he couldn't, it was just too much. Like, when you're talking this level of heat, 130, now this is what it was in the shade, okay? So it was 113 degrees or 45 degrees in the shade. So if you're like, if the sun's like beating down and you're in like a heated area, like a car or a house with no cooling, it's gonna be much hotter. So it's literally like being in an oven. So we rang SPOSnet, which is our energy provider, and they told us, it could be up to 5 hours, which it was. I have been sitting in a cold bath for 5 hours with my son. Luckily, we got a really, like, big square bath, filled it up with really cold water. We were just absolutely boiling. It's so hot that there's no one out. There was no one out. They were all inside. There's been, the hospitals are just filled. They're absolutely filled, apparently. Like, because I put it into Vic ambulance, paramedic, and it's just like they were just like absolutely fit chock-a-block. The ambulance, the wait for an ambulance is like so long too. So like, what happens if, you know, something, you know, like me, I've got intracranial hypertension, I've got too much cerebral fluid. When I'm hot, it makes it so much worse. Like, I can have a seizure, I can have something happen, and what, they wouldn't be able to be here to come and help me or my son. It's just been a terrible, terrible day, and I've just been praying to Jesus. And I just think, imagine if, you know, really did go bad, and this was like, this was our reality permanently, and there was a huge EMP or something, and this was our life. Like,
That was YouTuber Jay Mace Stojanovic during a 113-degree heat event in Australia during January 2018.
Heat wave conditions have been observed in different parts of the country. Mumbai recorded the second highest temperature in March in a decade with 38.7 degrees Celsius yesterday. According to the Indian Meteorological Department, the next few days are likely to be hot in Mumbai with temperatures hovering around 41 degrees Celsius. The mercury level in Gujarat as well has crossed the 40 degree Celsius mark and is likely to increase further as per the Met Department.
But let's go to a place where Western news just falls off the end of the world. I'm talking about India. I have been there, and it was hot. Now with climate change, India is going way beyond hot. In fact, as you will hear, parts of India are already beyond the 2 degrees supposed safe target set by the Paris Climate Accord. They have already blown past that.
While I have showed you the annual increase for India, we have also done a seasonal anomaly chart for India. Seasons in India is divided in four parts. We have winters in January and February. We have pre-monsoon season, which we also call as summers, which is March to May. We have monsoon season, which is June to September. And we have post-monsoon season, which is October to December. Now, let me show you what the temperature increase in these four seasons look like on a spiral. The seasonal increase in temperature actually looks much more dangerous than the annual increase in temperature. In the three seasons, winter, pre-monsoon and post-monsoon, the temperature in India has already increased by more than 1.5 degrees over the baseline of 1901 to 1930. But if you look at just the winter month of January and February, the temperature anomaly is actually more than 2 degrees. In fact, in 2017, the temperature anomaly in winters was 2.95 degrees. It is only during the monsoon month when the temperature increase is about 1 degree Celsius. So in three out of four seasons, 9 months in a year, the temperature in India have breached the aspirational goal of 1.5 degrees set in the Paris Agreement. This is becoming dangerous. Much sooner than anticipated.
That was Chandra Bhushan at the Center for Science and Environment in New Delhi, India. In an article published March 29, 2018, Isha Bajpai reports, quote, according to a recent collaborative study by the University of California and IIT Bombay, summer mean temperatures in the country have increased substantially from 1960 to 2009. Southern and western India experienced 50% more heat waves between 1985 and 2009 than the previous 25-year period. Similarly, heat wave days and mean duration of heat waves have increased by approximately 25% in the majority of India, the study observes. End quote. The nonprofit DownToEarth.org further reports that the government of India really has no way to record heat deaths. Only heat strokes and heat exhaustion are counted when they are reported or examined at all. But heat kills many other ways, from organ failure to strokes and more. Each year since 2015 in India, the government reports somewhere between 1,000 or 2,000 heat deaths, but the real number is much, much higher. And we are just beginning to enter the age of heat. Let's get to our feature interview. We don't need to blame the Russians or even Donald Trump for killing a government response to our climate danger. It turns out an American cabal of billionaires has been at it for decades. How do the super wealthy and their politicians talk about climate change? As superstorms and superfires strike, what has been going on in the shadows? Dr. Lawrence Shoup has a PhD in history. He's been a social activist since the 1960s. Shoup has written many articles for magazines like Zed Magazine or Z Magazine and published 5 books. His first in 1977 was on the Council on Foreign Relations, and his latest in 2015 is Wall Street's Think Tank, the Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976 to 2014. Chapter 8 of that book is called Fiddling While the Earth Slowly Burns, The Council and the Ecological Crisis, 1990 to 2014. And that's what I hope to talk to Larry about. Larry Shoup, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on, Alex.
It's a pleasure to meet you finally. I have read some of your work before. Larry, activists in the 1970s and the 80s, we knew about the Council on Foreign Relations, but I'm not sure millennials do. What is the CFR?
It's a private organization, corporate dominated. In fact, I call it a capitalist class organization because the top leadership is capitalist class people who are interested, of course, in organizing the world to increase their wealth and accumulate capital. But they also have a very important component of experts, people from the main universities in the United States, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Columbia, Johns Hopkins, Chicago, Stanford. Those are the universities that the council draws on for some of their academic and intellectual leadership. And that's an important component because the council wants to define issues in the way they think they should be defined, and then mobilize a consensus among the capitalist class along, you know, for whatever they want to do in a particular situation, and then go out to the educated public through their magazine, Foreign Affairs, that's their magazine, and get a consensus around a particular policy. So their strategic planning, they have a very important part of their work is a think tank, that is study groups that bring together these capitalists, bring together the academics, and define a problem, decide on solutions, and then disseminate those solutions into the larger public through the media. They have lots of contacts with media. It's a very large organization. It's a private organization, but they've got 5,000 members, individual members, U.S. citizens, and then they have about 150 corporate members, which are the big multinationals. So this is a very important and powerful organization behind the scenes. Their people go into the government. Characteristically, they become the leaders in the government. In Bill Clinton's administration, for example, Clinton himself was a member of the council, the Secretary of the Treasury, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, etc., were all members of the Council on Foreign Relations. So that was typical. The current Trump administration is a bit atypical because they have less representation of council individuals, but they have a very large representation of council representatives from council corporate members. Corporate members, by the way, can be international. So Deutsche Bank is a corporate member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Eni, the Italian oil multinational, is a corporate member of the Council on Foreign Relations. They also have a global advisory board, which brings together very important capitalists and leaders worldwide into their advice network. So the council is this very important, big, complex organization. I've just, you know, gone through it in detail in Wall Street's think tank, of course, but it really requires a study to understand it completely. But that's in brief what it's all about.
And what was the first climate report by the Council on Foreign Relations?
Well, they didn't really have a study group on this, but in 1990, they had a book that came out, a council book. They put out their own books. They put out tens of thousands of various kinds of products, books, blogs, reports, articles by their staff. They have about 100-person intellectual staff at the council that puts out lots of academic products. So one of their products is books, and they had a book called Sea Changes, where they talked a little bit about the climate crisis. The Sea Changes was mostly about talking about the changes in the world at the time, led by the decline and demise of the Soviet Union. But they did have Robert Heidelberger, a very important intellectual, had been a member of the council for a while, although he dropped out later on. And he talked about how there was a looming confrontation of capitalist dynamics with the limits of ecological tolerance. Due to fossil fuel use, as we all know, carbon emissions are rising, and this, of course, creates a climate effect. Global warming, that's one part of the ecological crisis. And the council, of course, doesn't want to talk about all parts of the ecological crisis because that would be a holistic understanding of it. And they're interested in a more narrow understanding of it, just dealing with part of it. And so the first one, really, the first time they really talked about the ecological crisis was in 1990. And Heidelberger said that the political will was the problem. There's not enough will to make the changes needed to prevent climate change. Government intervention was required. The market role, which, of course, the council is a capitalist organization dominated by big capitalists like David Rockefeller earlier. Today, David Rubenstein, a billionaire, is the chairman of the council. They're interested in market relations. They're interested in neoliberalism, more privatization, more market power. Whereas in order to solve the climate crisis, you have to have more government intervention. So Heidelberger pointed that out and said that this was going to be a big problem, and there was a question whether capitalism could absorb the drastic restructuring which is going to be necessary in order to save the planet. Our planet is in dire straits, I think, and human beings are under threat of extinction in a very short time, a few decades, I think. It's a dire situation. We're seeing the beginnings of some real serious things with hurricanes, with droughts, floods, fires, all the things that we notice that are going on the planet. The ocean is getting in serious shape. Oxygen is depletion in the ocean, acidification in the ocean, pollution of the ocean. These things are all extremely dangerous for life on Earth, including human life on Earth. So we have to challenge capitalism. We have to overthrow capitalism and have a different system. I believe we have to have an eco-socialist system that's fully democratic, that has ecological principles as the main thrust of the society, not getting more wealth for people who are already super wealthy. So anyway, that was the first in 1990. Then it went on, and they actually had a study group. They waited. Heidelberger kind of warned them that this is a really important topic, but it's a difficult one because it deals with the whole capitalist accumulation situation, which is what the capitalists want to keep accumulating. They have no limits to how much money they want to get. Unfortunately, the people that run our society and so many societies in the world. So then they had a study group finally in 1998, which was called the Victor Study Group. That was not interested in changing capitalism. It was more focused on technological solutions and also the Kyoto Protocol, which the United States never subscribed to. But, of course, when we start talking about these UN-organized protocols like the Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement, unfortunately, it's mostly PR. There's nothing very serious behind these. It's mostly telling people everything's fine, don't worry, we've got the Kyoto Protocol, and, of course, that collapsed, and now we have the Paris Agreement, which, of course, Trump, who's a climate denier, doesn't even want to subscribe to, but it's very weak in any case, and is not going to solve the problem. We need kinds of things like we had during World War II when we wanted to have the atomic bomb. There was an all-out effort on that. We have to have that kind of a scale of effort in order to solve the problem. So anyway, the first study group was this Victor Study Group in 1998, and it just came up with some tacks. It said it recommended emission trading, which is another weak solution that you have in some places. You have it in Europe and you have it in California, but it mostly results in cheating. There's not really very much limits put on emissions. And of course, again, that's just only part of the problem. We also have ocean acidification. We have a number of other issues around the ecological crisis that are very serious besides climate change.
Now, according to your research, Larry, ExxonMobil played along with these climate change is a real threat reports from the Council on Foreign Relations, where they were members. But at the same time, ExxonMobil donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to establish the Heartland Institute, one of the biggest denial outfits anywhere. Does the CFR ever criticize its members, or do they vet who's allowed in? Do they ever kick anybody out?
I don't know of any case where they kicked anybody out. People have dropped out, various people, because they got, for one reason or another, the council was either too progressive, which is, sounds strange, but extreme reactionaries will see the council as too progressive. Of course, I think it's in a way short of being progressive, but that's right. ExxonMobil was very important in is very important in the council. Their previous chairman was a member of the council, and they've been a corporate member for many decades. Members, representative members of the ExxonMobil were in these study groups. There was the first Victor study group. There was a second one as well, that the ExxonMobil representative was there, along with BP as well, representative from British Petroleum. So they have them in the study group in order to listen to what they have to say and maybe be convinced. So these study groups, as a result, their recommendations are watered down at best. And so ExxonMobil went into those not necessarily saying, oh, I'm going to go along with the council's program. They're going to change the council or influence the council's program to make sure it fits in with their needs. In the case of this first study group, the Shell, the guy that was the chair of the study group, Rodney Nichols, was a consultant for Shell Technical Ventures. So they were talking about technologies that might limit global warming, but they were complementary to Shell Oil's profit. So you know you're not going to get anything very serious out of that result of that study group. So that's right. ExxonMobil has been involved in this. They are funding climate, or they have been at least in the past, heavily funding climate deniers. But by the end of that study group program in 2009, they were able to get their program through the House of Representatives of the United States, and that was a cap-and-trade program. Like I say, that kind of system results in a lot of cheating, and so it doesn't really do that much to change things. But they failed in the Senate to get it through the Senate. It did pass closely in the House in June 2009. This was a council program, and it passed in the House. But then the Senate, because the Republicans totally opposed it, and BP, ConocoPhillips, Chevron, ExxonMobil, and Shell all lobbied. Those all corporate members of the Council on Foreign Relations. They all lobbied against the program. So they weren't on board, even though they'd been involved in all these study groups that the council had had. They still weren't on board with even cap and trade, which I guess is very weak and doesn't do that much. And so by 2009 and a little bit after that, a few more years after that, the council kind of gave up on even trying to do anything to try to limit the pollution and all the problems of climate change and the ecological crisis, and just went into denial. That not directly denial, but in effect denial, saying we have to have growth, therefore we need to be using fossil fuels. Capitalism requires growth. It's a expand or die system, and therefore we're not going to do anything about it. So Richard Haass is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's been the president since around 2004, I think he became president. He's still the president. He wrote a book in 2013, Foreign Policy Begins at Home. And he said, if you have low growth for too long, you have dire consequences of class frictions. Now, that's one thing the council doesn't like to have, is class frictions, because it's a capitalist organization, and the capitalists don't even like to talk about class or capitalism. That's kind of almost forbidden, except in their own circles they might talk about it. But as far as the broader public, they'd much rather talk about race or gender, because that doesn't get into their profits and into their power. So he said this would have caused class frictions. That is, there would be the rank-and-file people who aren't getting extremely wealthy on all these fossil fuels. They might rebel against this. So we better keep growth going. And growth going demands using fossil fuels. So they kind of threw up their hands by the time this book came out, 2013, and said, well, we've had these study groups. It didn't result in anything that's useful from our point of view, so I guess we're just going to have to adapt to global warming. Well, and the other aspects of the ecological crisis. Well, as we know, that is the road to destruction, and we're seeing that with the climate chaos that's now developing on our planet.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith, and for a very long time, my guest, Dr. Larry Shoup, has been tracking a shadowy group of power brokers called the Council on Foreign Relations, and we are looking at their record on climate change. I wanted to ask you, Larry, what are the findings of the 2009 CFR report, The Canadian Oil Sands, Energy Security versus Climate Change?
Well, this was one of that five study groups that I mentioned, and they decided because the tar sands are worth an estimated, at that time they estimated, the tar sands were worth $8.5 trillion. And so they had this long analysis about the geopolitical aspects, the national security aspects, the climate aspects, and decided that because it was so valuable, they concluded that rapid tar sands development should continue. And so this, of course, as we know, is extremely dirty oil. It's really a bitumen, and you have to, in order to get it, you have to cut down some boreal forests in Canada that are, ecologically pristine, and create a wasteland that's absolutely horrible. If you look at a picture of the forest and the rivers before they mine the tar sands, and then you look at the disaster afterwards, a big pit spreading over the landscape, and of course, this is ecologically disastrous because, of course, we need those trees to absorb carbon. So anyway, they concluded that the tar sands development should continue. Now, of course, we do face a different situation because in those days, this study group was 2004, and since then, fracking has become a big thing, and the U.S. is not as short of oil as it was. The U.S. used to import something like 12 million barrels of oil a day. That was in 2006. Today, it's down to 1 million barrels a day, around that, because fracking has been so successful. So if they had another study group, they might come to a different conclusion, although we're not sure because the $8.5 trillion always, that's an unbelievable amount of money. And, of course, it's smaller than the trillions of value of coal or the trillions of value of Saudi oil or some other country's oil. It's still less than that, but it's still a vast figure. And, of course, the capitalists running the Council on Foreign Relations, that's their main concern, is getting more profits. So the tar sands were approved.
And what was the independent task force, and what is its relationship to the Council on Foreign Relations?
Well, that's an interesting thing because the Council portrays itself. If you read their own documents, they say, oh, we're an organization that's nonpartisan. We're Democrats and Republicans. We don't take policy positions. Of course, this is all a front. They do take policy positions all the time. They take it in various ways. Their president is always elaborating different policy positions, as are their other leadership people are advocating lots of policy positions. And they go in and out of the government when they make policy. So they're in and outers in the sense that they're in private enterprise and also members of the council, and then they go right into the government. There's many cases where the government has taken wholesale many people from the board of directors of the council right into the government as top leaders. Of course, they're always very high leadership, including the secretary level. So the council says there that they don't take policy positions. They get around it in various ways, and one of the ways is this independent task force idea. So they say, we're going to choose a task force and give it a topic, and we're going to choose the people on the task force. All the people there will come from the council, many of them council members, but not always all of them council members. There maybe 15 out of 20 will be council members. The others will be some other people that have on a particular topic. Say, for example, North Korea. The council just had a study group on North Korea, which they recommended very harsh measures against North Korea, very much in line with Trump's positions, even though, like I say, they don't have as many council people at the leadership level in the Trump administration as other administrations. But still, they came up with this policy that's very close to the Trump positions on North Korea. So they bring in some people who may be expert on something that they're interested in that particular. So anyway, this independent study group ploy, it's kind of a ploy where the council can make recommendations and say, oh, we didn't make any recommendations. So they choose these people, they choose the topic, and then they say, okay, now you're independent. So that's what the independent task force, and there was this independent task force that they had in 2008 to 2010, and it was called the Independent Task Force on Climate Change, and they came up with cap and trade as the solution to the problems of climate change. And so it was a very high-powered study group, and that's the one that recommended to the U.S. Congress that you should have cap and trade. And it was, as I mentioned, it was passed in June 2009 by the House, but not passed in the Senate because there wasn't enough consensus within the capitalist class. And this is something interesting when we start to get into consensus among the capitalist class. There's still a lot of consensus within the capitalist class. But Trump has, because he's not a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, he's kind of a nouveau riche. I can backtrack and say the Council is a plutocratic organization in the sense that the old plutocracy has been dominant in the Council on Foreign Relations for a long time. The Rockefellers were very prominent in the early days, but there were also other prominent American families the Mellons and the DuPonts and all of those were very prominent in the Council from a very early date. And Trump is kind of a nouveau riche and does not connect as well as previous administrations with the Council on Foreign Relations. They've had to work a little bit harder to try to get him to go along with their policies. It seems to be that that's the case, and they're making recommendations that are very much in line with what he's wanting to do. And so they still have a lot of power. But there is some dissonance within the capitalist class right now. I'm still, because a lot of this is happening behind the scenes, I'm still kind of scoping it out because there's a paperback version of Wall Street's think tank that's going to come out. And I'm writing an afterword for it. And so the afterword has to deal with the upgrades or the changes in the council leadership and also the Trump administration and how that fits into the council. And then a couple case studies, the tax reform, so-called, which is just a tax gift to the rich in the United States and the corporations in the United States. That one has been recommended by the council for a long time. That's exact tax reform we're very close to, the tax reform, so-called, that the Republicans have passed. So that case study is pretty clear. The North Korean one is also pretty clear that the council's recommendations are being followed by the Trump administration. So there'll be a couple case studies in that. So anyway, there's a paperback edition of Wall Street's think tanks going to be coming out, and I'm working on that. So I am dealing with this question of within the power structure, what's going on, because it is interesting and it is important, and there seems to be more conflict than in the past.
But in the end, though, Larry, from my reading of your work as it is now, it sounds like the Council on Foreign Relations looked at climate change, realized it would bring serious chaos, including damage to the oceans and extreme weather events that were going to be very expensive and heat deaths. They knew all that, but they still said, we need capitalism no matter what, so we have to accept climate change. We just have to accept it. And that seems to be their policy.
That is. You're right. This is lamentable, but they're imprisoned by their own mentality, and they can't get beyond it. And so that means the average person, the rank and file, and the intellectuals need to work on uniting the population around a program. I call it, this is subject to a dialogue and discussion and struggle among, thousands and millions of people. But I think eco-socialism is the answer. That is a fully ecological program, similar to what the Green Party's transitional program, but that's, I think we can go beyond that with the ecological program that we need, was fully democratic, but then could begin to implement some serious changes that we need in order to save the planet.
Do you think capitalism has to crash with the stocks and big corporations going bankrupt to save the Earth?
Yes, I do. I think that's going to be the first step, and I think Trump's policies might lead to that because he doesn't want to have regulations. The capitalist people of the Council on Foreign Relations, they're more interested in having some regulations. Trump wants to get rid of all of them, and his people in the very limited perspectives of the Republican Party in the United States now, it's very narrow in its thinking. That could cause a crash. Unfortunately, there'll be a lot of suffering. I'm not in favor of people suffering, but we need to work on the municipal level to try to assure that there is locally grown food everywhere where we can do it, in vacant lots, in backyards, and also, of course, agroecological types of gardening and agriculture is very good for the earth in the sense it can draw out carbon. If you have an agroecological system like no-till farming, where you cut off, you don't dig up the ground. When you dig up the ground, you allow carbon to go in the atmosphere. If you don't dig up the ground, but you have an intensive type of agriculture, you can pull carbon out of the biosphere. So that's one of the solutions that we can work on, is a municipal-oriented, locally grown food that could save the earth over time if we extend that kind of agriculture to a much bigger basis. Industrial agriculture with all this use of fossil fuels, pesticides, chemicals, is a dead end.
But we still have consumerism. I mean, I want to buy a new truck. I want to buy a new car. I want a new TV. I want more and more. We're all part of this. I mean, we'd like to blame the capitalists, but we want all the powers that fossil fuels give us as well. So it's pretty hard to assign the blame. And the other problem that I have is that you're talking about the workers are going to save us, which was Karl Marx's idea as well. But now what we have is very low-paid workers. We have an unhealthy population, a lot of addiction. People are stressed out, working two or three jobs. They're in debt, or maybe they depend on the government directly. So it seems almost like there's zero working-class consciousness in America. And some of those who do recognize themselves as workers voted for Trump. What do you say?
I think you've put your finger on a lot of our problems. But education and the realities that people are going to be facing. Remember, we're just seeing the beginnings of some catastrophes that are going to be pushed on us. And people are going to have to get local and start getting in communities like community councils, neighborhood councils, to talk about solving problems. And I think in those forums, more radical measures will come forward and people will realize that what our better future is for everybody is not consumerism and getting more and more consumer goods, but community and caring for each other and survival with more free time and less goods. I don't know what's going to happen. Obviously, nobody does, but that's what I would hope would happen, is that we focus on municipal power and we get away from the consumerism, which does affect us all. That's what's leading to that kind of the lack of community, the lack of consciousness, the lack of caring for each other is what leads, the lack of love, what leads to the opioid epidemic, what leads to these other things, the isolation of people instead of working in communities. Our communities have been destroyed, and that's why people are alienated, and they'll grab on to anything, and therefore many workers did vote for Trump, of course. More workers voted for Clinton, but of course Clinton was very close to the Council on Foreign Relations. Hillary Clinton was not a member, but her husband's a member, her daughter's a member. She went to the council in 2009 and said, when she was Secretary of State, and said, we get a lot of advice from the council. I hope you keep advising me. This is the Secretary of State telling the council, I get all my advice from you, or a lot of it, and I want to keep getting advice from you. Thanks a lot. Where's the power? The power there is at the Council on Foreign Relations. So Clinton wasn't a good choice for people. And because we have a really limited electoral system, which is not very democratic, it's run by the billionaires, it's run by the media, the billionaire media, there's no public financing, there's no proportional representation, there's no instant runoff voting, or, ranked choice voting. So the voting system is backward, it's first past the post, there's billionaires investing in politicians. Of course, the consciousness is low. Fox News, of course, is the epitome of a media that's manipulating people, making them dumb, and it's owned by and run by Rupert Murdoch, and he's been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations for a long time. Although he was a member for over 25 years, and then for some reason he disappeared from the membership list in recent years, the last couple of years. So I don't know why he quit. I don't think he was kicked out, but he did. No longer appears, but Rupert Murdoch and Fox News have been an important source of a lot of these problems, the mass media. So we have to, as a population, as a people, organize ourselves to fight this in order to survive. Because, like I believe, we're on the cusp of some even more serious ecological disasters and destruction of some ecologies. The ocean is in serious trouble, and that is a source of a lot of our oxygen and an important part of our food. So we destroy the oceans like so much that we are destroying. We're moving on the road to destroying ourselves. And unfortunately, the Council on Foreign Relations has given up on doing anything about it. So we, the people, have to, even though there's all these formidable obstacles, which you point out, correctly point out.
Well, maybe we have to get knocked down a little further before we stand up and fight for an Earth that's worth living in for our kids and grandkids.
I think that's right. And I have a couple grandkids that I'm very concerned about. And I do want other people to think about that and stand up. Of course, you know, we know that revolutions have only occurred when things were dire. Russia in 1917, things were extremely dire. There's nothing like that in the United States or these other countries that you have mentioned today. But things are going to get worse if we kind of think about how bad it is going to get and start to try to mitigate or prevent by moving and raising people's consciousness, moving forward towards the revolution that we need. And, of course, I talk about some alternatives. Eco-socialism, I outline in the concluding chapter what an eco-socialist society is. It's a different civilization. It's a different kind of, totally different kind of civilization. So that's what we need to move towards. I don't have all the answers, but together we can have all the answers. We can dialogue and come up with the answers as a people. And that's what we need, even internationally, of course, beyond just the United States and other allied countries. We need to be international and go beyond that as a people, as a species.
From Chicago, we've been talking with Dr. Larry Shoup about his book, Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics from 1976 to 2014. You can find out more at lawrenceshoup.com, and that's Lawrence with no W, S-H-O-U-P. And you can find more links in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Larry, thank you so much for spending some great time with us.
Yeah, thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Radio EcoShock.
Apparently, it doesn't matter if the world is authoritarian, democratic, communist, or capitalist. All those forms of government support expanding the economy, draining more resources, and pushing pollution out into the land, water, and atmosphere. Do we need industrial civilization to crash in order to survive at all? The West Coast author and deep green thinker Derek Jensen says yes. I interviewed Derek in 2007, and wow, that was 11 years ago. He's produced a lot since then, so pretty soon, when I've drunk in some more Deep Green Jensen, we will do another interview with Derek. To get you started, I'm going to toss you right into the deep end with an audio from one of Derek's most recent videos. It's called More Thoughts on Technics, as uploaded to YouTube on March 11th, 2018. Good luck.
So we've talked before about authoritarian and democratic technics. Lewis Mumford talked about how technologies don't arise in a vacuum, but they emerge from and then give rise to certain social structures. And he found they fell into sort of two categories, democratic and authoritarian technics. And a democratic technic would emerge from and give rise to democratic power structures. An authoritarian technic would emerge from and give rise to authoritarian power structures. And a great example would be anything that involves mining, because nobody wants to get into a mine. And so you need an authoritarian power structure to enforce people getting into the mine. So if you have any technology that requires mining, it's going to require the entire social system that goes with it. And then once you have a technology, it affects how you perceive the world. So for example, if you have automobiles, that affects how you perceive the world. That makes it... You know, I live 3 miles from a grocery store. We could talk about grocery stores as a technic too. Anyway, I live 3 miles from a grocery store. So if I forget something at the grocery store, it's no big deal because I can just drive back and get it. But if I had to walk the 3 miles, that would change how I perceive going to the grocery store. So they're also authoritarian techniques, not only because they give rise to authoritarian power structures, but because they themselves become authoritarian and they can run the society. So that's one reason, for example, that cities are designed for cars more than they are for human beings. We created this thing, and then suddenly we have to design the entire living space around that. Or that's also why, as this culture is killing the planet, and as global warming is just running amok, that's one reason the very, very few of us are the only ones who are talking about stopping industrial civilization, because industrial civilization is in charge. It is more important to these people than a living planet. And so that's how technologies can come to control us. And so why is that important to be able to name? And I'm going to step back from that for a second and talk about, I still remember when I was in my 20s, a friend of mine called me up and she was reading a book on post-traumatic stress disorder. And she started reading off some of the symptoms of PTSD. You know, I was abused as a child, and she was too. And there were, you know, insomnia, night terrors, a strong startle response. And as she was reading off this list of symptoms of PTSD, we were both just marveling. Someone is describing our experience. And I know similarly, I know someone who has been in the past couple of years diagnosed with bipolar. And when he was diagnosed, then a friend sent him some literature on it, and he was weeping with gratitude because someone was describing his experience, and they were able to put a label on it, and they were able to put, to bring, here's another way to look at this, is that, you know, I have Crohn's disease, and it wasn't diagnosed for quite a while. I had severe diarrhea, I had bleeding, I had all these problems, weight loss, nausea, vomiting, terrible pain. I had all these symptoms. And then to find out, to get a story, this is Crohn's disease that leads to these symptoms, to get a story that made sense of all these disparate symptoms was incredibly helpful. It's like a doctor friend of mine says, that the first step toward proper treatment is correct diagnosis. And so that's one of the ways that naming authoritarian techniques has been really helpful for me. I didn't name them, Lewis Mumford did. But reading Mumford about that, that's one of the reasons it was really helpful, is because it helped me to make sense of a lot of disparate facts. I kept asking myself for decades, who's in charge? How is it that we human beings have created social systems where in which most of the people are spending most of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? In other words, working a job that you have to pay rent, to survive on the planet. And that's, how did we create a system? How did a system get created that is so, in which not even the humans are primarily benefiting from the system? It's just where most of us are spending most of our time doing things we don't want to do. That just seems crazy to me. Or why would you create a system that systematically destroys the land? I didn't understand any of that until Mumford really helped with that, with putting a frame. I suddenly understood how these technologies can end up essentially driving society. So I think that this particular video is in some ways about techniques and why it's important to be able to name them and how that helps. And then also it's about the larger importance of, if you have a constellation of problems, to be able to, that insight helped make sense of the otherwise nonsensical behavior. Suddenly all her behavior made sense. And Mumford's analysis of techniques helped make sense of so much nonsensical behavior. Why has there been a food production and distribution system created that leaves many people starving? And that makes many people dependent upon the system as opposed to their land base. Why would that happen? Why would there be a system where most people are working jobs they don't love, and on and on and on? Why would cities be designed for cars? All these examples I've already given. Why would the military get huge amounts of money when schools are left without funding? And the authoritarian techniques notion. Help me comprehend all that.
That was Deep Green thinker Derek Jensen in a YouTube video called More Thoughts on Technics. Find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org and find Derek at derekjensen.org. If all goes as planned, we will have a chat with Derek soon on Radio EcoShock. So map out your shade and your spot in the sun when it's safe enough to go out in the sun, and raise your voice against the machine. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening.
We're back here on Unusual Sources. That's 93.3 on the FM dial and CFMU.ca for the rest of the world outside Hamilton, Wentworth. You can live listen to us on our streaming service or catch our archive at CFMU.ca, and you'll find the links to our SoundCloud page. Now, of course, there's a lot of big stuff planned for April, and we're ahead of that. We're ahead of the game. We have Rabbi Dr. Lucia Pizarro with us today. And she is going to be telling us about some of the things that are going on. So thanks very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you.
Well, we've had a lot of your friends and relatives on the program to talk about some of these related initiatives. It's been a big year for independent Jewish voices, and it's been a big year for some of the affiliated or related organizations and things that are going on. And I know we're talking specifically about the Jewish Liberation Theology Institute in your case. This is something we're paying attention to, especially at this time of year. It can seem that in many ways, Jewish rights, religion in general, might have become somewhat ossified in recent years, you know. And it strikes me that about 100 years ago, the Jewish religion and culture was very much alive. It was changing with the times, perhaps changing the times, a force for progress at times and associated with a lot of causes. But today, things seem more stagnant, in my view, until we saw a growing body of people involved in the Jewish community who have been reintegrating into progressive causes, who have been asking questions about what is the role of Judaism today, what has happened to the religion, what is happening in terms of renewal. And there's more discussion and activity. Jelethan is part of that, and it's very exciting to us. And one of the things we've talked about on this program in the past with Robert, Allison, and others has been the Liberation Seders that are happening in Hamilton. You've been pioneering that. You've been doing important work on that, and it has reached national or even international attention. We've talked about it before, but every year it seems that there's something a little different and something new. There's always things that are being remembered, special attention being paid to things. I understand this time you're going to be remembering the Nakba, and I'm wondering, can you tell us how you arrived at doing so and what had happened in the previous year?
Every year we commemorate whichever Palestinian commemoration is closest to Passover and to the Seder in particular. And usually that could be any of three things. It could be remembering political prisoners, remembering the massacre in Deir Yassin, or remembering Land Day. This year, the first night of Passover, of Pesach, falls on the same day as Land Day, Palestinian Land Day. So we're going to be remembering Land Day. But this year also, it is the 70th anniversary of the Nakba. So we will be remembering both the Nakba and Land Day, which are, I see them as related.
Certainly, and it relates to the larger question of oppression, which I know is going to be covered in various ways this month. So the Liberation Seders, I've been to the one in Hamilton more than once. I can't remember if I've been to the one in Toronto, but it seems you've got three happening this year. There's actually going to be one happening in London, if I remember correctly. So are you expanding the Liberation Seders?
Yes, we want the more liberation theaters, the better. The more people can link the theme of liberation of a theater to the struggle of liberation of Palestine, the better. So we are very, very pleased that we are doing this now in three cities.
Yes. No, it is a welcome development. And for those who are just tuning in, we're speaking to Rabbi Dr. Lucia Pizarro, who is helping coordinate and run the Liberation Seders, as well as other events that are happening in April. We're very excited about it. In fact, before we go on, I want to help people find the website or the material. You have a Facebook page and a dedicated website. Where can people find the Jewish Liberation Theology work that you're doing on the internet?
The website is jelithin.ca. It's the first two letters of each word, jelithin.ca.
Right. .ca, Jewish Liberation Theology Institute, so jelithin.ca.
That's right.
And it's on Facebook.
Yeah.
You can just look up the acronym, jelithin. Well, I mentioned that because I was looking through that yesterday, and I found – you actually have the Haggadah, the Passover Haggadah for this year on the website. And this Haggadah, it talks about oppression and it talks about resistance and it talks about liberation in the context of Jewish people in their struggle and Palestinians and all sorts of things like that. And I'm just wondering, it seems that this one's a little different. You have a 2018 Haggadah. So, you know, how have you incorporated Palestine into this year's Haggadah?
The story of the Haggadah, the first Seder that we did was in 2009. And in 2009, we were in Toronto, and we were six people, and I wrote my own Haggadah because I couldn't bear the idea of celebrating the liberation of the Hebrews, and in Judaism it means that we have to celebrate our freedom, knowing that the Jewish state is oppressing the Palestinian people. So the only way I can do anything during Passover is by doing something around the struggle of liberation of Palestine. And so I wrote my own Haggadah to do that. But then I went to rabbinical school and I didn't have time to be writing my Haggadah every year. So we started using IJAN's Haggadah, which is the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network. And that's the one we used. Then they changed their Haggadah because they also updated every year. And then I didn't like the new updates, so I kept the old one. But then I started changing a few things. And, for example, last year, Rabbi Mevaser changed all the blessings because he didn't want hierarchy in the blessings. So he no longer used the word sovereign in blessings, but he changed it to source of all worlds. And also he added plagues that affect the oppressor, the state of Israel. And this year the changes that we make are small, but it's every year we make a few changes. So I think the Haggadah is becoming unique.
Yeah, I noticed the changes. Very interesting. And of course, people can find it because they go to the website and you have, I think it's a PDF document or something, and you can just download it and look at it on your tablet or print it out or something. That's really neat. So you can know ahead of time what's going to be happening on Passover. Now, you mentioned Rabbi Mevaser. Of course, he's been a guest of this program. And so he's returning this year. Is that just for Hamilton?
Yes.
Okay, that's interesting. That's lucky for us in Hamilton. He's a very energetic character, and it was pretty good last time around, and when he spoke on various issues. So if you go to the Hamilton Liberation Seder, Rabbi Mevaser will be there. How closely are you coordinating with him on this?
Pretty close, but he has his own style. I will be leading the other two Seders, the one in Toronto and the one in London. And I keep telling Rabbi Mevaser what to do, and he keeps doing whatever he wants. But people love him, so we let him.
It's like herding cats. Well, no, that's so for the listeners, we just want to get some of the details out there, at least for the Hamilton one. I mean, we know that the Facebook page mentions where you can find the Toronto Liberation Seder and the London Liberation Seder and the Hamilton one. What day is the Hamilton one taking place?
It's Monday, the 2nd of April at 6:30 in New Vision Church. That's Easter Monday.
Easter. Okay. So that's a lot of our listeners, of course, know where the New Vision United Church is. And of course, it's a highly accessible location, accessible by wheelchair, but also various forms of transit. You can take your car and park in a big parking lot nearby, or there's about 5 buses that stop right beside New Vision United Church. And that's just a few days from now. So we're giving people the earliest morning we can. We've had a lot of events, other types of events this month, so we've been busy, but we want to make sure people know about that. So they can, do they need to like register in advance or something?
They do. People, please register in advance because we need to order enough food for everyone.
That makes sense. You've got to plan it all out, and then you have to know how many people to sit and all that sort of thing. So it's a quite involved process. So we want to know before it starts if there's a way to do that, of course, via communicating you through the Facebook page or the website. And you have I saw you have the contact information there, so that's fine. So that is spectacular. You have this just a few days from now. You said the 2nd of April here in Hamilton. We have a tradition now. This has become a sort of tradition, although it's always changing and evolving and developing in Hamilton. So I noticed there's always new people at the Liberation Seder. You know, I've been to 3-4 in Hamilton, and it's not the same group of people every time. I mean, there's just a lot of the same people are there each time, but there's always new people. I guess that you feel good about that.
Yeah, we always have the regulars that include you and your family, and we always have new people. That's the way it works in all the cities. Well, in London, everybody's going to be new. But in Toronto and in Hamilton, we usually have a core group of regulars, and then we meet a lot of new people every time.
So, I mean, for those who might not know, this is, of course, open to everyone. It's not simply for Jewish people, of course, that is a core part of it, obviously, but it's obviously open to all people who are concerned about social justice and anti-oppression and liberation, and that's a wide range of people, and you've had a wide range of people there, so that's who we hope to get this year.
We also have people that are just curious and want to learn what's going on and not necessarily subscribe to the views of the Seder.
But it's the real deal. You've got the whole evening planned out, and to the extent you encourage people to eat beforehand, I believe, because it's going to be some time before they get.
Well, you know, traditional seders, you have to read the whole Haggadah before you eat, and that can take hours. So we do an abbreviated version of this seder, but that is still a good hour. This year is going to be more than an hour. I want the Palestinian speaker to speak before the meal. But I don't know what David Mevaser is going to do. But he also speaks forever. So, yeah, don't expect to come to an event and have dinner served. It takes a while for dinner to come.
Well, forewarned is forearmed. We want people to not be caught by surprise on that issue. Okay, well, so that is a triple event. Toronto, London, Hamilton, the Liberation Seder, and it will be on April 2nd. And I know people out here in Hamilton have access to that. They can get to that. There's also an event later in the month, and that's what prompted us to bring you here because of this. You've got 3 events with the Liberation Seders going on in here in South Ontario, and then you have this other event in Hamilton at the end of April. So for people in Hamilton, there's 2 events they can go to, the Liberation Seder and the visit of Reverend Dr. Naeem Atiq. Now, this is something I'm not familiar with, although I've interviewed many of your colleagues. I've interviewed David Mivisser and quite a number of people from Independent Jewish Voices and so on. I'm not familiar with the Reverend Dr. Naeem Atiq. I understand he's going to be speaking about Palestinian liberation theology. Not an area of expertise for me. I'm not sure if we know a whole lot about it, but what can you tell us about Palestinian liberation theology?
Well, first of all, Naeem Atiq is one of the founders and creators of Palestinian liberation theology, also one of the founders and creators of Sabil, which is the organization that is about Palestinian liberation theology. When I lived in Jerusalem, I heard him speak a few times. And Palestinian liberation theology is based on traditional liberation theology, which is a contradiction in terms because liberation theology is not traditional. But anyway, liberation theology is a theology that sees the world through the eyes of the oppressed. So the way you learn about things is through the eyes of the oppressed, not through the eyes of the privileged people that have money to go to university and write books, but through the eyes of the people that are suffering from poverty, from oppression, from all different types of oppression. So in Palestine, Palestinian liberation theology is about seeing the conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, through the eyes of the oppressed. This means through the eyes of the Palestinian people. And this view of the conflict and of the world is attached to Christianity. Palestinian liberation theology is a Christian liberation theology that sees the world through the eyes of the oppressed, in this case, the Palestinian people.
And that's what you do. Specifically, liberation theology, you are focused perhaps on Jewish liberation theology, but when someone like Naima Teek comes along, of course, this is someone you want to work with because he's also involved in liberation theology. So I suppose it prompted you to help feature his tour and everything like that. I guess, is that what he's going to be talking about on later in the month of April? It's going to be about this unique Palestinian liberation theology that he's been developing?
Yes. It is a book tour, a national book tour that he's promoting his new book. His new book is about Palestinian liberation theology. So he's going to be talking precisely about Palestinian liberation theology. And for us, as the Jewish Liberation Theology Institute, it is obviously very exciting to be hosting Palestinian Liberation Theology Institute, so to speak, which is Sabil. And yes, we're very, very happy about this.
I have not seen the advertising go out for this, for example, on the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War yet, because it's been busy with a bunch of other events, and it's about to come out for the advertising for April, and this is all going to be sent out. But for the event information, is this on the 30th of April? So it's April 30th, right at the end of the month.
Yeah, it's Monday, I believe, also, Monday 30th of April, and it's an evening talk about Palestinian liberation theology at New Vision.
Right, so as long as they know where that is, they're okay. This is exciting because we have right here in Hamilton a Jewish liberation theology organization and people trying to press ahead on finding out how Jewish theology relates to oppression as it exists today and liberation as it exists today, which is an exciting and highly relevant question. So now that you've and your partners have established this institute, what exactly are you hoping to see in the near future or the distant future? I guess I'm wondering, you know, how do you want Jelethin to change the world or change Judaism?
The way it was conceived was by meeting young Jews that came to Jerusalem. I was living in Jerusalem at the time, that were thirsty for some kind of Judaism, some kind of spirituality that would speak to them. And they were also very interested in fighting for Palestinian human rights. And they couldn't do both, because currently, if you go to any mainstream Jewish organization, there is a level of Zionism that is very uncomfortable for people that are aware of the oppression of the Palestinians. So it becomes impossible to participate in Jewish activities because you enter these buildings and you feel very uncomfortable with the narrative and the blind spot of these people. So I decided that I was going to create a space for Jews to act Jewishly without the constraints of the establishment. And it turns out that a lot of people feel like I do. And these people are not usually part of a community, precisely a Jewish community, for all the reasons that I just mentioned. So I think that's the reason why the growth of the Seders has been so huge and so fast, because there are a lot of people that feel this way, and there is no systematic way of finding these people, because you can't go to a particular place and find them, but people keep somehow finding out about us, and it's usually people that are not only not affiliated to Jewish communities, but also they are very far removed from religion, from tradition, because it's become uncomfortable for them. So when they learn that we exist, a lot of people get very excited and want to be part of this.
I understand completely. Certainly, there are a lot of people who their social conscience has been developing very rapidly, and, you know, official Judaism has not kept pace with that, to put it mildly. And so now you've created a focal point, and there's a number of focal points across the country and in the United States by which people can try to reengage in a Jewish religion in a way that isn't supporting settler colonialism and oppression and that sort of thing. So that's very important. And there is indeed a sea change that is occurring, and you've seen it yourself. You mentioned it here. Certainly among the youth, you did mention young people as an inspiration for the activity you are now doing. And it's true. Official Zionism is, you know, it's losing a lot of youth all over, from the United States, Canada, Great Britain. And certainly you can see the panic in the various newspapers and establishment media outlets. And all this, what we've had for the last 50, 60 years just doesn't resonate in terms of people's growing consciousness and the social justice activities that have been spreading in Canada and the United States about decolonization and indigenous issues and anti-colonial issues and anti-war and anti-occupation and so on. So obviously there needs to be new structures and organizations to deal with that and to sort of represent that. And I think that's what you're doing. So it's very interesting to us, and it's very interesting to people in Canada generally. And we are indeed seeing the growth of organizations and media outlets that discuss these sorts of things. So I'm very pleased that you could be with us today, Rabbi Lucia, because I know you are very busy in your personal life, and there's a lot of, you're balancing and juggling a lot of things. So it means a lot to us that you could come into the studio, and I know that people in Canada are grateful that you can share your time with us and help express and explore what it is that you're doing in Hamilton. So there's going to be opportunities for people to be part of these things. People can go to the Liberation Seder on April 2nd. They can see the visit of Reverend Dr. Naeem Atik on April 30th. The information is all out there on the Jelethin website and Facebook group. That's jelethin.ca, I think you said. Yes, .ca. So I hope people go to that. There is information out there. There's the Haggadah. It's on the website right there and everything like that. So you can see what's going on and perhaps get involved. So thanks again, Rabbi Pizarro, for being on the program with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jim Loeb, journalist and founder of Loeblog.com, who discusses Donald Trump's appointment of John Bolton as his national security advisor and the implications for U.S. policy in Iran, Korea, and elsewhere around the world. Excerpts of speeches by students and a teacher at the March for Our Lives rally in Shelton, Connecticut, one of more than 800 events organized on March 24th, demanding the passage of common-sense gun regulations. And investigative journalist and author Yasha Levine, who examines charges against Cambridge Analytica for harvesting millions of Facebook profiles in the larger issue of the unregulated collection of personal data for profit. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
An advancing Taliban insurgency in Afghanistan has triggered a wave of refugees who are fleeing the conflict. After 4 decades of war, over 2 million Afghans are internally displaced, and Western humanitarian aid agencies are scrambling to address the growing crisis. Increasing numbers of U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan have left residents in rural villages extremely vulnerable, forcing many to leave their homes. In response to the crisis, the Norwegian Refugee Council has increased its aid budget by $30 million to assist displaced Afghans. At the same time, Afghanistan has become a very dangerous place for aid workers. In late 2017, the Red Cross cut back its assistance programs after a series of deadly attacks on their staff. Ironically, the Christian Science Monitor notes, the Taliban capture of new territory has also meant relative peace in some areas, a fragile calm that could be disrupted by an influx of several thousand new U.S. troops deployed by President Trump with orders to fight and win. President Donald Trump and the Koch brothers are backing new measures in Congress to expand the role of private providers at the Department of Veterans Affairs. Veterans groups who support the VA's record on health care are pushing back, asserting that privatization harms veterans who need integrated care. Organizations representing veterans are now teaming up with progressive unions and single-payer advocates to fight privatization. Roberto Clack of the Right to Heal VA campaign says despite management problems, the VA provides quality care for the people who use it. Critics charge that privatization exposes sick veterans to lower quality care, longer wait times, and providers not willing to share medical records with the VA. Privatization, strongly backed by the Koch brothers and others on the right, could threaten 250,000 union jobs at the VA. Thus far, congressional Democrats have been able to block the Trump GOP privatization agenda and the transfer of $2 billion to what's called the Veterans Choice Program that promotes private health care for vets. During the night of October 11, 2012, U.S. Border Patrol officer Lonnie Swartz shot across the Mexican frontier from the border wall in Nogales, Arizona, killing a teenager in Mexico, Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez. Witnesses in Mexico say Rodriguez was peacefully walking down the street the evening he was shot 10 times in the back by Border Agent Swartz. After years of legal wrangling by the Rodriguez family, a U.S. grand jury indicted Swartz for second-degree murder. The case, now on trial in Tucson, Arizona, is the first time a U.S. Border Patrol agent is being prosecuted for a shooting death on the Mexican side of the border. If successful, the case could lead to foreign nationals winning the right to sue the U.S. government for American forces' deadly attacks on civilians in places like Afghanistan. The trial comes as President Trump continues to press Congress to pay for his proposed controversial $20 billion-plus border wall between the U.S. and Mexico. The activist group Southern Border Communities Coalition says U.S. border control agents have killed 50 people along the frontier since 2010, where no one has been held accountable. 4 years ago, an independent group, the Police Executive Research Forum, examined the use of deadly force by border agents, criticizing the agency for incidents in which agents opted to shoot at moving vehicles and rock throwers rather than avoid conflict. In those types of low-threat incidents, the group recommended prohibiting agents from responding with deadly force. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As Donald Trump continued to make major changes to the personnel in his administration, the firing of National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster last week created an opening for a critical position in the White House. That the president decided to fill that vacancy with the appointment of war hawk John Bolton was not so surprising, but was nonetheless greeted with concern and dread in the U.S. and around the world. Bolton, who served as George W. Bush's United Nations ambassador, is well known for his role advocating for the disastrous 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, and more recent calls for a military first strike against North Korea, and a preemptive attack on Iran's nuclear infrastructure. Bolton, a regular commentator on Fox News, has long opposed the 2015 Obama administration-brokered international agreement with Iran that halted the Islamic Republic's nuclear weapons program. With CIA Director Mike Pompeo's recent nomination to succeed fired Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, And Bolton, scheduled to start his new job as National Security Advisor on April 9th, there's widespread speculation that President Trump will decide to pull the U.S. out of the nuclear pact with Iran when he must decide whether or not to waive sanctions against Iran on May 12th. Your reporter spoke with Jim Loeb, the former chief of the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Interpress Service and founder of theloeblog.com. Here he discusses John Bolton's views on the use of military force, as well as the implications for future U.S. policy in Iran, Korea, and elsewhere around the world.
John Bolton is a pretty unique character in that he's kind of the hawk's hawk. He even puts many neoconservatives somewhat on the defensive. He believes strongly in military solutions to political problems. He doesn't like the idea of nation building. And unlike the neoconservatives, he really is not into promotion of democracy, which neoconservatives have always given a great deal of lip service to, although sometimes there's been a failure to back that up, particularly with respect to certain countries that they consider to be allied to the United States. He's very much of an America firster, but he believes the U.S. military should be involved in the world and should be prepared to use force at all times. He's way to the right, very much on the militarism scale, even though he took some considerable efforts to avoid military service during the Vietnam War.
Jim, it seems there's an important date coming up in mid-May where Donald Trump will be on the spot to decide whether to continue on observing the international nuclear agreement with Iran or not. And he certainly sent many signals that he wants to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. What are the repercussions for that nuclear agreement with many other important nations around the world if the U.S. and the Trump administration does decide to pull out?
Well, I think it's a little hard to predict. A great deal depends on the position taken by the major European powers, Britain, France, and Germany, as well as the European Union itself, all of which are parties to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is the formal name of the nuclear deal. They were negotiating, that is the what is called the EU3, they were negotiating until last week on possible, quote, fixes, unquote, to the JCPOA. And even then, it wasn't clear that if they went through with those fixes, that Iran itself wouldn't walk away from the agreement. Because by its nature, any, quote, fixes, unquote, would violate what was agreed to in 2015 when the JCPOA was concluded. What is likely, what I personally hope, is that the nomination of both Pompeo and the appointment of Bolton will actually make clear to all concerned that the United States is really not serious about fulfilling its commitments to the JCPOA. And that will stiffen their spines. And if they show that they do have spine, that they're willing to counteract any U.S. renunciation of the deal, by counteract, that would mean essentially encouraging their companies to invest in Iran or to sell to Iran, and indicating in no uncertain terms that if the United States does anything with respect to increasing military tensions or actually taking some form of action in the region against Iran, that Europe will not be with them.
Now, the other very concerning policy issue that will be coming to a head quite soon is the planned summit between Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. We're going to have John Bolton whispering in Donald Trump's ear in the lead up to that summit, whenever it actually does occur. There is a lot of danger, is there not, in a failing at that summit, which could lead to greater tensions than we even had before in the last year and a half.
Yeah, I think that's quite possible. I mean, Trump is uninformed, as we all know. Bolton denounced the idea of any negotiation with North Korea, let alone a presidential summit with North Korea. I don't think anybody knows what to expect, but I think Bolton will try to use this scheduled summit, if if it does take place, to say, well, okay, we extended our hand and we didn't get everything we wanted. The North did not agree to denuclearize within a certain amount of time. So now we have to prepare for military action. And again, nobody knows how that's going to turn out, because, of course, North Korea is actually a nuclear armed state with the ability to deliver nuclear weapons far and wide. I mean, the result of Bolton's appointment is, if nothing else, our traditional allies, be they in Western Europe or in Northeast Asia, like Japan and South Korea, are going to distance themselves increasingly from Washington, even just because of Bolton and what he represents and how he's acted in the past. They're pretty frightened by the possible consequences.
That was Jim Loeb, the former Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief of Interpress Service and founder of theloeblog.com. For more analysis and commentary on John Bolton's appointment as Trump's new national security advisor, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The March for Our Lives Against Gun Violence drew hundreds of thousands of students and their supporters to Washington, D.C. on March 24th, and to more than 800 other sibling marches across the country, in big cities and small towns, as well as cities abroad. The town of Shelton, Connecticut, organized their own March for Our Lives rally, which drew about 600 people to Veterans Memorial Park on the banks of the Housatonic River. Shelton is just 15 miles away from Newtown, Connecticut, where 20 elementary school students and 6 educators were killed in a mass shooting on December 14, 2012. The speakers in Shelton were mostly local high school students, along with one teacher, and staffers of 2 Connecticut members of the U.S. House of Representatives. House members, and especially the state's 2 senators, Richard Blumenthal and Chris Murphy, have been tireless in working for passage of gun safety measures in Congress, completely without success, until the Valentine's Day massacre of 14 students and 3 staff at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. That tragic mass shooting paved the way for the passage of modest gun safety measures included in the fiscal year 2018 appropriations bill, which was co-sponsored by Senator Murphy. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the Shelton rally and brings us excerpts of talks by 2 students and 1 teacher who spoke there. We hear first from Shelton High School senior, Tyler Monroe.
I am afraid to go to school every day because I overanalyze the goodbyes I say to my mother every morning. And as I walk up to that big brick building, I think over the lines I said in my mind, wondering if they were worthy of being the last words she ever heard me speak. I am afraid to go to school every day because of the plans my classmates and I have made. We hope to go into the military, or perhaps we already send our deposits into our colleges. And I wonder how many of those names on those attendance lists will not be called because those kids did not survive to see this year's autumn. And I should not be afraid to go to school every day because I do not know if I will survive. Students should not walk the halls worrying about the nearest exit in case the PA system announces that there is an armed person in the building. Weapons do not belong in a building where the sharpest things should be students' minds. I should not be afraid to go to school every day because fear should not meddle with learning. The only worry that should ever exist in such an academic environment is the anxiety for an upcoming test. The information we learn should not be skewed in our minds because we are too worried about the fate of our lives. And I should not be afraid to go to school every day because the path to graduation is so uncertain. Schools across the nation are wondering which one will be next. And school is no place for the fear that my fellow students and I will not live to hear the dismissal bell ring. Thank you.
My name is Caitlin Botsford Tucker, and I am a social studies teacher and a mom. I'm so glad to be speaking to you today, but I am saddened by the reason for this march and the marches taking place across the country. 32 lives at Virginia Tech. One was a friend of mine. 26 lives at Newtown.
17 lives at Stoneman Douglas. The Department of Defense reports that the number of children killed by gunfire in the United States since 2012 surpasses the total number of American soldiers killed overseas in combat since 9/11. Last week, 7,000 pairs of shoes were placed on the U.S. Capitol lawn to represent those lives. Today, students across the country are making it clear that they won't stand for inaction. They are making it clear that they want common sense gun legislation to make sure these tragedies stop. But it isn't easy. Students like Julia and Tyler know this. All the students here need to know it too. It's never easy. It's never easy to speak out when you see something wrong in the world. But you have to, because democracy is not a spectator sport. Movements are made up of moments. And you should know that this moment is important in this movement. Did you ever think you would be part of a movement? Because you are. You've organized, you've brought us all here, and you've made your voices heard. In my profession, we tell kids to believe in themselves. We tell kids to stand up for their beliefs. We tell kids to care about their community and the people in it. I'm standing here in awe of how well these students have listened. And I know that this is only just the beginning of what you can do. You're proving that you're up for the challenge. Because even when just two or three gather in the name of justice, there is hope. You are the hope for the future. Your voices will be heard, and you will make a difference. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Colby Tremblay, and I'm a junior from St. Joseph High School in Trumbull. Let's arm our teachers with resources, not weapons. Let's give them the tools they need to teach, not the tools to kill. It is a teacher's job to educate, not to fight for their lives and the lives of their students. So I ask all of you today, do not let this be the end of the conversation. We can be the generation that ends gun violence. We can be the generation that ends school shootings. This is our history. Thank you.
Those were excerpts of talks by students Tyler Monroe and Colby Tremblay and teacher Caitlin Botsford Tucker at the March for Our Lives rally in Shelton, Connecticut, recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Cambridge Analytica, a London-based data analytics firm, which worked on Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign, has been the subject of a blizzard of recent news stories, following revelations that the company harvested 50 million Facebook user profiles and used that information to micro-target voters. The company is owned by right-wing billionaire Robert Mercer, and Trump's former chief strategist Steve Bannon was a founder who also served as vice president. The company partnered with Alexander Kogan, a researcher at Cambridge University, who designed a personality quiz app, which Cambridge Analytica paid 270,000 Facebook users to install on their profiles. Data from those who installed the app and their network of Facebook friends was later used to target voters with political advertisements on behalf of Mr. Trump. Your reporter spoke with investigative journalist Yasha Levine, author of the new book, Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet. Here he examines the charges against Cambridge Analytica and what he believes is the more critical issue of giant social media companies' unregulated collection of personal data that is used to make billions in profit.
No matter how scummy these guys at Cambridge Analytica are, and they are scummy, there's no doubt about that. What the company does, taking data on people and using it to help shape elections and influence elections, on behalf of some kind of client, usually a political campaign or a wealthy donor of some kind. What they do is no different than countless other political data-driven election companies do, right? This is very normal in this day and age to use these kinds of techniques, these kinds of psychological profiling, psychometrics, using data pulled from social media, right, and using that data with other data they pull from voter files, from third-party data brokers, from the candidate's own donor lists that they compile. The Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and various elements within those parties have their own companies that do this kind of stuff. You know, Charles Koch, for instance, lavishly funds, which is basically his own data-driven election influence outfit called I360. As bad as Cambridge Analytica is, it's just one of many players that are very similar, and it's not even the big. Well, the kind of data that Cambridge Analytica can pull or had pulled on 50 million Americans pales in comparison to the kind of information that Facebook itself has on those people. We have to remember that Facebook is in the business of surveilling its users, right, compiling profiles on its users, and then selling access to those users, to advertisers, and to anyone who wants to buy ads on their network for the purpose of influencing their decisions, right, to influencing them to buy a certain product or influencing them to vote for a certain candidate.
Tell us a bit of what we might not fully understand about the business model of Google, Facebook, any number of applications that we put on our smartphones, the games that we play, our cell phones and the use of cell phones on a daily basis. What is going on with our unregulated collection of personal data by these companies, how it's sold, and what are the negative consequences beyond annoying ads that might appear as you're browsing the internet? What are some of the consequences you're concerned about regarding this unregulated collection of our data?
Companies like Google, for instance, Google mediates a huge chunk of our digital life. We carry, a lot of us, 70% of the phone market, if not more, is dominated by Android, the mobile operating system. So 70% of, 7 out of 10 of people who have a mobile phone carry Google in their pocket, right? And Google goes with them wherever they go. And Google also mediates their phone calls, knows who's calling you. It mediates their web browsing, so it knows exactly the websites that you go to. It knows what you're searching for. A lot of people have Gmail, so they're emailing everything, right? They're emailing with their friends, with their colleagues, with their business partners, with their doctor, with their psychiatrist, with their bank, right? All that data, all the attachments in your emails are being scanned, are being monitored, and are being used to compile profiles on you that's being constantly updated. Down to extremely personal information between you and your doctor. Google can know things that you don't even really put into the box. And so the level of information and the intimacy of that information that companies like Google, but also Facebook, because Facebook can collect much of the same information as long as you have the Facebook app running on your phone. The level and intimacy of that information is just kind of stunning. To even just think about that it's very frightening. To know that giant corporations like these can collect that information, and there are no limits on what they can do with that information or what they can collect. There are no regulations, there are no laws that limit or direct in any way the information that they collect on us. It's stunning, but it's true. You know, you don't have to really think too hard about why this is troubling, right? Because while companies like Facebook and Google have been able to sell a progressive side of themselves, to cloak themselves in this progressive image, that they are these companies that are really, only want the best for the world and are trying to make the world a better place. And the truth is, they are, giant profit-seeking corporations like any other. They're really no different than Koch Industries or Philip Morris or ExxonMobil in the sense that they are giant corporations that want to bend society and the political systems in which they exist to their will so they can make more money. I think in a democratic society, no one should have that kind of power over the democratic process.
Europe has recently moved to something they call a GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation Plan.
Are there any similar moves here in the U.S.? And what, in your view, should that regulation consist of?
It's a good question. You know, I've been actually trying to understand what this GDPR. You know, I don't know if I can fully comment on that. But look, there are no moves in America. I mean, the closest thing that's happening now to regulating Silicon Valley and its for-profit surveillance business is what's called the Honest Ads Act. It's an important piece of legislation, I think, but it's very limited in that sense. It only applies to election and election advertising. But other than that, there's really nothing. There are no limits on what Silicon Valley can collect, the information they can collect on you.
That was Yasha Levine, author of the new book titled Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet. Learn more about growing concern regarding internet advertising companies' unregulated collection of personal data by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Newton, Massachusetts, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
When babies rebel. They came from across the country. They assembled in almost 100 U.S. cities and in cities around the world. Who are they? Teenagers, high school students mostly. They were the survivors of the latest Valentine's Day massacre from the carnage of a Florida school where deeply troubled young men waged war against other young people and made Marie Stoneman Douglas High the latest American death site, like Sandy Hook, Virginia Tech, Columbine. But something new emerged from the death and destruction in Parkland, Florida. The children rebelled. They looked at the so-called adults who were supposed to protect them and, perhaps for the first time, truly saw them. These adults, police and politicians, looked at their pain and barely raised an eyebrow. They were too busy protecting the gun lobby, the NRA, who paid millions for such service. They learned that if it was a conflict between their worth as children and the interests of the rich and powerful, they would lose. So they screamed at the adults' world, its hypocrisy, its evil, and they rebelled. They protested and shook the nation. They woke from their childish slumber and saw politics as the poison it's always been. Their voices now echo around the world as a new youth movement emerges. They now know something that separates them from the play and folly of childhood. They know that they can no longer depend on the adults. They know that they must organize or nothing will change. From imprisoned nations, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan. of Prison Radio. Half a century of revolution. On the move, I greet you all in the city of Seattle on this fine, auspicious occasion. The 50th year celebration of the founding of the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party is, as it must be, also a celebration of the very existence of the Black Panther Party itself. It is a celebration of grassroots resistance to state repression, a celebration of black resistance to racist oppression, and a celebration of a youth movement against the stifling conformity of the status quo of the 1950s and early 60s. 50 years ago, African nations were emerging from decades, some over a century, of European colonialism. Asia's Vietnam was fighting to free itself from American military occupation after besting the French at Dien Bien Phu. Black activists like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, called SNCC, dominated the news, and a young, dark man then named Stokely Carmichael broke through more than most. In September 1967, Carmichael brought black power to Seattle when he spoke at the University of Washington and shortly thereafter at Garfield High School before some 4,000 students. With his passionate delivery and calls for black revolution, Carmichael electrified his audience, as he did whenever he spoke. Elmer Dixon, then a member of the Black Student Union, reacted coolly to Carmichael's hot rhetoric, stating, "I didn't agree with anything he said. He used the word honky a lot. My best friend was white, and that didn't sit well with me." Elmer and his brother Aaron, who would later be named defense captain of the Seattle chapter, were sons of parents who were college professors. And thus, they came from middle-class backgrounds, as did several other activists who began in the civil rights movement and migrated to more militant movements like the Black Panther Party. The Seattle branch, organized in 1968, became the first chapter of the Black Panther Party to rise beyond the borders of California. In spring 1968, Chairman Bobby Seale and Minister of Education George Murray visited Seattle and met with the Dixon brothers and several other young Panther aspirants before granting Seattle full membership. I've always thought that there were never really just one party, but 44 different ones, depending on where it got organized. Seattle was not Harlem, Philadelphia, Baton Rouge, nor Boston. In a very real sense, every chapter was different, but Seattle, because of its local history, seemed more different than most. Seattle, before the Second World War, had some 4,000 African-American souls. But as the Great Migration reached into the 60s, its black population grew at the rate of over 400%, according to scholar historians Judson Jeffries and Jeffrey Zane. Many of the Black Panther Party chapters opened in cities with large black communities like Harlem, Chicago, Philadelphia, Baton Rouge, Baltimore, or Boston, for example. Seattle, with its relatively small black community of less than 10%, had its own unique challenges as well as its own opportunities to build amidst a multicultural population base. Thus, their free breakfast program served not only black kids, but Italian and Asian kids who crowded into the party's Atlantic Street offices in a neighborhood known as Seattle's Little Italy for a hot meal before school began. Few party branches had such access to such broad communities. Like every other city, the party had its birth, its high points, and its passing into the mists of time. Today, 50 years after its founding, We now gather to remember its proud and glorious birth. We remember its bold, majestic place as a grassroots movement of young people who fought against ignoble state repression. We remember its place in American, Black, and world history. In parting, let me give the party's slogan that echoed all across America and still has a certain kind of power 50 years later. All power to the people. I thank you for your time and your opportunity. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
The following is a repeat broadcast of the Global Research News Hour, which originally aired January 12, 2018. Why should the Cuban people and their supporters be cautious about the normalizations of relations between Cuba and the United States started under President Obama? What Trojan horse strategies are being used to subvert the Cuban Revolution from within? Is Trump likely to alter the revisioning of the U.S.-Cuban relationship initiated under Obama? What is the Hans Seidel Foundation and what role did it play in an October 2015 conference situated in the island nation? How does the co-opting of the Cuban intelligentsia further America's soft coup of the country's revolutionary project? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we probe the U.S. government's rapprochement with Cuba in recent years and assess whether the reboot of the relationship represents an opportunity or a threat to the Cuban people. We'll speak to Arnold August, a Cuba scholar and author of a recent book on the subject. We'll also speak with Michelle Chosadovsky of the Center for Research on Globalization about his experience with a conference financed by a German NGO aligned with U.S. imperial interests. On today's program, Obama's Trojan Horse, America's Cuban Soft Coup. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 12th, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory and the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. You can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. While some nuclear powers have ruled out ever launching a first strike, the U.S. has long refused to make such a position, with President Obama's brief consideration of such a pledge quickly panned as making the U.S. look weak. Even without the pledge, the current crop of arms are for all intents and purposes unusable except in an extinction-level nuclear exchange. Such a strike would simply be too big and too much of a humanitarian disaster to seriously contemplate, which is where these smaller nuclear arms come in. Pentagon officials see the introduction of more tactical nuclear arms as a way to build arms that are usable at a much lower threshold and seem to be shrugging off concerns that this will effectively normalize nuclear warfare. That comes from the article, Trump Administration Prepares More Hawkish Position on Nuclear Arms, the Deployment of Mini-Nukes, by Jason Ditz. Post January 11th, originally appearing at antiwar.com. Military intelligence is almost always directed against foreign targets, and there are multiple ways to describe the practice of this art, but the most relevant one is to draw attention to a four-step process that, interestingly, begins and ends with democracy. The first step is to develop concepts that can serve to widen societal divisions, second step, that provoke a crisis, third step, and allow for the implementation of reverse-engineered endgame solutions, final step. While there are many theories that can catalyze the sequence and conclude it, regardless of whether they're the same for fulfilling both roles or are different, democracy is the same effective for killing two birds with one stone. Part of the universal appeal for democracy is that people believe that it's the best way to hold decision makers accountable in ensuring that they fulfill their promises to increase the living standards for the general population and empower individuals to actualize their full potential. Democracy, however, is also the proverbial Pandora's box, and there's no going back once the ideals of this theory have either been introduced or practiced in a society. That comes from the article, U.S. Military Intelligence Has Weaponized Democracy Worldwide, by Andrew Korybko, posted January 11th, originally appearing at Oriental Review. The increase in the number of U.S. troops is not to secure the country or annihilate the U.S. creations, the Taliban and ISIS, but rather a show of U.S. power to rivals Russia, China, and Iran. The reinforcement of air power under the new strategy killed tens of civilians in blind bombardments carried out by the criminal U.S. Army in several parts of Afghanistan in just a few weeks. The only people cheering for this new strategy are heads of the mafia puppet government of Afghanistan and their intellectual lackeys, because their master has decided to elongate their ominous lives by extending its stay in our country. We should not be deceived by the U.S.'s pressure on Pakistan either. The history of the U.S. and Pakistan go back decades, when the filthy government and terrorist fostering army of Pakistan trained and exported the most bloodthirsty and reactionary groups to our country in accordance with the orders and dollars of the White House. That was an excerpt of an interview conducted by Edu Montesanti with FREBA, a representative of the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, appearing under the headline, U.S. Needs the Taliban to Justify Its Military Presence in Afghanistan, posted January 11th. I have just read through the new United States National Security Strategy released by President Trump in December 2017. There have been many comments on it, most of them focusing on the hostility in the document towards Russia and China, but also some question of what the strategy is. Well, after reading page after page of delusions, bombast, bragging, bullying, lies, fantasies, and deep-seated megalomania, you discover that there is no strategy. They don't have one. The only use that document has is as irrefutable evidence that the government of the United States is what they like to call a joint criminal enterprise intent on seizing control of the world for its sole interests. That comes from the article, Trump's National Security Strategy, or NSS, War and More War, by Christopher Black, posted January 10th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. For more than 20 years, Arnold August has traveled to Cuba for extensive periods as part of his investigative research into the Latin American country. He's an accomplished journalist with an MA earned at McGill University in Montreal, where he is based. He's the author of the 2013 book, Cuba and Its Neighborhoods, Democracy in Motion, published by Fernwood Publishing and Zed Books. And on Thursday, January 18th, he will be speaking in Winnipeg at McNally Robinson Booksellers on Grant Avenue to launch his latest book, Cuba, U.S. Relations, Obama and Beyond, also published by Fernwood. Arnold August, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay. So your book, your latest book mostly explores this supposed watershed in relations between the U.S. and Cuba around the pivotal date, December 17th, 2014, or 17D, as it is referred to, when President Obama and President Raul Castro jointly announced a normalization of relations, in spite of welcoming the development as a positive step. You present it as the latest front in a new U.S. incursion into the country. When did you begin to smell something rotten, that things aren't quite as optimistic as they're being presented?
Okay, that's an interesting question. So just to put this in context, I did welcome it as a very positive step. For example, it's the first time in over 50 years that the U.S. and Cuba have established diplomatic relations. And as well, as you recall, there was a very important event that day that the remaining Cuban five who were in prison at the time were returned home that very same day on December 17th. So I consider that to be a very positive step.
Well, so did I, actually.
Pardon?
So did I, actually. I mean, in spite of whatever cynical elements.
Yeah, right. But at the same time, I do, as you say, with a lot of pride, I'm not ashamed at all in saying that, that I also see a very negative side. And you asked, you know, when did I first begin to smell something rotten? I have to tell you, quite frankly, as soon as Obama, or while Obama was speaking on December 17, 2014, I saw, you know, I saw what the negative thing was immediately. And, you know, probably similarly to you and other people who are listening, I follow U.S. politics quite a lot over a long period of time, and I'm familiar with the domestic politics, how the, you know, presidential candidates and the presidents act in the United States. And so I have this habit of reading very carefully what is said that specific day with the Obama statement, as well as several White House statements that were released on that day in 2014. Now, he said very clearly, Obama said very clearly, that he said that the Cuban policy before Obama was a failure. Now, he said that, it's true. Now, some of the media, mass media in various parts of the country, they jumped on that. He admitted that it's a failure. It would be wrong to say that he admitted it was a failure. You have to look at the sentences that come right after that in the document as well as in his actual speech, which we heard on that day. He said it was a failure because we did not succeed in bringing the changes to Cuba that we wanted to. That is to bring democracy to Cuba, to bring to make Cuba into a market economy, that is to abandon socialism and adopt a U.S.-style economy, neoliberal economy. He also said it was a failure because our goal was to isolate Cuba, and instead of isolating Cuba, it was the United States who became isolated over the last few years. That is, the Latin American countries, all of them, opposed the U.S. blockade against Cuba, and they support Cuba's right to oppose the blockade and self-determination for Cuba. So the bottom line of this, Michael, is that the goal of Obama, and I read through it immediately on that specific day, that, well, it's time for us to change tactics. What we tried did not work, that is, did not reach the objective of subverting the Cuban Revolution. We have to take tactics, change tactics for new ones that will allow us to succeed in subverting the Cuban Revolution. So his basic change, the Obama change in policy, was one of the traditional U.S. Policy of aggressive comments, whether it's from the Bushes or the Clintons or others before him, to change from aggression to seduction. That is, instead of trying to subvert the Cuban Revolution from the outside, the goal was now to subvert the Cuban Revolution from the inside. And that, of course, was symbolized more clearly than anything else when Obama went to Havana in March 2016. So that was the basic change in the U.S. policy towards Cuba as it was reflected in Obama's statement on that day.
Could you talk a little bit about, I mean, you were talking about, I guess you use the term Trojan horse in this new strategy. And I'm wondering if you could talk about some of those tactics that's been opened up in the in the wake of this new detente. I mean, the U.S. seems to be hedging their bets that they can somehow infiltrate Cuban society and get people within, as you say, within Cuban society to internally reshape the system and overcome the objectives of the Revolution of 59. Our listeners are familiar with the National Endowment for Democracy and USAID and these other CIA proxies, essentially, which promote quote-unquote democracy.
Well, it's very good that you educate your listeners on that. I think that, in my view, is one of the key points in international politics at this time.
So what is actually happening? I mean, some examples of what's actually happening and what's being executed in Cuba.
I could give you an example that took place not too long after Obama opened up this, what is called a thaw. You know, what kind of a thaw is it if they continue continue the democracy promotion programs in Cuba after the establishing diplomatic relations with Cuba with the goal of subverting the revolution? I can give you one very concrete example. If you have amongst your listener, if you have youth and students, in the fall of 2016, it became known in Cuba that the United States, through the USAID program, was recruiting some Cubans online who would be given bursaries, who would be given a special aid to go from Cuba to United States for education on how to become leaders in Cuba, how to bring about change in Cuba, of course, according to the U.S. version of what change means for Cuba. Now, this was uncovered by the Cuban students, and there was it provoked a lot of demonstrations and activities against this specific USAID program. And it was interesting that one of the people they actually recruited was a patriotic student, who, when he came back, he told a live audience on Cuban TV about what was happening when they were in the United States. And this is, in conformity to what you mentioned with regards to USAID. They would get to the United States, and all of the program was about how good American democracy is, talking about the elections going on at that time, and how to become an appropriate leader in Cuba to bring about changes in Cuba. So this is a very, an example of what we call trying to subvert the revolution from within. And this is, of course, made easier by the fact that Obama changed the tactics, and with a smile on his face, or the smile on the face of U.S. imperialism, tried to promote the subversion of democracy from within. And I think another point, if we could still dwell on the issue of Trojan horse, if you don't mind,
sure,
is that there's a lot of noise, given the impression that, Obama was a good guy. He tried to open up diplomatic relations with Cuba, which he did, but also with its negative impact, while Trump is so terrible. Of course, Trump is terrible. There's no doubt about it. But the point is that the Obama policy of subverting the revolution within is being carried out under Trump, with Trump not even being obliged to do anything towards that. It's sort of been handed on the platter to Trump. I'll give you a concrete example. When Obama visited Havana in March 2016, amongst his many activities there, he had a meeting with what are called small private entrepreneurs, small private business owners. Now, in that meeting, one of the people was the owner of a T-shirt, small T-shirt boutique or factory in Havana. And when Obama introduced her, he was very aware. He mentioned her by name. He said that he would like to buy T-shirts for himself and his daughters and all that. He made a big fuss about it the way he can with his Ivy League approach and personality and all that. And she, of course, spoke on the need to have United States American assistance and how to develop this type of small business. Now, of course, she later went on to study business at Harvard. So we could just imagine, or your listeners probably might ask, well, for a Cuban to go to Harvard to study business there. Is this not in contradiction with the Cuban socialist system? Of course it is, but they do not seem to see any contradiction in that at all when they go to Harvard. Now, what is important, I think, in the context of all this fuss about Trump is that about 2 weeks ago, the Miami Herald, which is, of course, very anti-Castro, based in that part of Florida, had an article featuring and promoting the owner of this T-shirt boutique, explaining how they're doing so well. They're even exporting the T-shirts to United States to sell there. And, you know, we can see it coming. They're becoming quite wealthy. But it's not so much the question of wealth, but the overall, when this person explains the goals of the T-shirts, it is obvious a goal to subvert the revolution. The name of the company that produces the T-shirts is called Clandestino or Clandestine. So right off the bat, it gives you an idea that they consider themselves clandestine or sort of a hidden or unhidden dissident within the Cuban system. Now, this is nothing new, but what is of interest in my view, that this is taking place now while Trump is there. And so the basic new approach of Obama and its effects, such as these amongst these small businesses who are looking towards capitalism as a solution for Cuba, this is going on right now under the nose of Trump. So, you know, the basic policy of the United States towards Cuba to subvert the revolution, whether it's through charm by like Obama or through pressure by Trump, the basic underlying thing is still going on regarding to try to get a section of Cuban society to distance themselves from the Cuban Revolution and look to the United States for a solution to problems that, in fact, exist in Cuba.
Now, there's popular depictions of Cuba in the mainstream media and elite institutions is that Cuba is not a democracy. It's a one-party state. They don't have freedom of the press. And this is maybe one of the that plays to that whole idea you're discussing about, you know, sort of dividing the people. Could you maybe address these perceived shortcomings of the Cuban government and this offensive of the need to bring a U.S.-style democracy to the country?
Yeah. When it said, of course, perceived, you're very right in placing that in that context, that it's perceived by the United States. Like, I personally never compare one system to the other. What I say, my basic view is, Cuba has its own political system that came out since 1959. In fact, it goes back to the second half of the 19th century. They have their own tradition, their own heritage when it comes to democracy, the participation of people in the political system, which is revolutionary. That is their system. And then the United States, we could be generous and say, well, the United States has their democracy. They have their way of doing things. Now, it's up to the United States and the people in the United States to bring about changes in the United States to make that system really democratic, which, of course, is a goal very far from being achieved. Now, to the same token, it's up to the Cuban people, especially the Cuban Revolution, to bring about changes in Cuba to improve their political system, to improve their electoral system, not to change it so that it's in conformity with the U.S. preconceived views of how a political system should be. For example, when Obama was in Havana in March 2016, and he had the opportunity to speak to the Cuban nation on live TV, he said, well, there are differences. Cuba has a one-party system, and United States has a multi-party democracy. So right off the bat, the word democracy, according to Obama and all U.S. presidents, including, of course, Trump, the word democracy is not fitting for Cuba, just by mentioning it that way, when, of course, ipso facto, United States is a democracy, irrespective of what people think. So this perception comes from the ruling circles in the United States from 1959 right to Obama, including as well as Trump, of course. Now, Cubans are they're used to this thing, this tendency of being lectured regarding democracy and human rights and all that, and they're pretty immune to it in the sense that they say, sure, we know that there are problems in our system, but it's up to us to change it. I remember very well, if we have time, I'll give you one anecdote from the time when John Kerry visited Havana in August 2015 to raise the flag near the American embassy to symbolize the fact that the American embassy in Havana is being reopened once again. And his speech was just quite diplomatic. It wasn't too bad. He said that what Cuba needs is genuine democracy. Now, right after that, there was a joint press conference held between, on the one hand, John Kerry and Bruno Rodriguez, who was the foreign minister of Cuba, the vis-a-vis of John Kerry, in which there was a question and answer period by the journalist present at the time. And one journalist from Associated Press, who was quite a good journalist, in fact, based in Havana, she asked Bruno Rodriguez, this thing about genuine democracy, what is your view about democracy in Cuba? And he gave a very simple, clear, and transparent answer. He said, well, I'm okay with a democracy in Cuba. Of course, it has to be improved as part of our striving to improve the social and economic system in Cuba. We have to improve it, but that's up to us. That's the way I feel. I agree with what he said. It's very well put. And I think that is really the issue, that each country has its own system. And in both cases, up to, in the Cuban case, to improve it, while I would say in the American case, it needs a revolutionary change to go from the type of system that exists now, which is very far from being democratic, to a system which in which people really have political power.
One of the things that came up in the book that I hadn't really reflected on much before was the role of bloggers in the development and the evolution of the political culture in Cuba, both in support of the revolutionary project and the dissidents. So I'm wondering if you could maybe comment a little bit on
that. Yes, of course. I think that's a very important point. In fact, in previous book events, this has been one of the main interests in which people have shown, and I will be dealing with this in more detail at the book event in Winnipeg next week. But just as a intro, I would say that in my book, what I present, I have chapter 3, which are interviews with 5 experts on Cuba-U.S. relations, experts based in Havana. And for the first time, an English-speaking audience has access to what they think with regards to U.S.-Cuba relations and the latest, what I call, you know, the latest adventure or incursion into Cuba that was initiated with the Obama new policy. And so what is not known is that, you know, people, when we look at the news, the media, they always, I guess your listeners are always also notice that, they always would mention some irrelevant dissident in Cuba and hold that person up as an icon of change in Cuba, etc. But I never see anyone mentioning these revolutionary bloggers, revolutionary writers in Cuba, who have take a very strong stand against this new cultural incursion into Cuba, led by the United States, and it's very interesting to see how they operate, what they write. Like, for example, when Obama was in Havana in March 2016, and he said various things that raised the eyebrows of many Cubans, these people wrote articles that very same night, and the next morning, those who follow their writings and read Spanish, we can see a very strong Cuban patriotic anti-imperialist position against Obama's pressure to change Cuba towards the type of system that he would want. So this is, I hope to be discussing this further next week at the book event. And also I definitely will go into what you raised here, the Trojan horse that is, it does exist in Cuba. It would be wrong to say, oh, no, they didn't succeed. Obama did succeed. It's very concrete evidence that concrete people, I gave you one example of the T-shirt boutique owner, that it actually exists in Cuba. And I would like to go into that in some detail next week, how this new example, or this example of a Trojan horse, also exists under the Trump government, who, in my view, is just riding the coattails of the Obama policy with regard to this incursion into Cuba.
Well, Arnold August, I think we've given listeners here in Winnipeg a good taste of what you'll be talking about, and they may be compelled to come out and see you, or, and better still, purchase the book.
Yes, right.
Cuba-U.S. Relations, Obama and Beyond, by Arnold August. And again, the date of that event is Thursday, January 18th. At 7 p.m. in McNally Robinson Booksellers on Grant Avenue. Arnold August, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And Arnold August joins us from Montreal, and he is also a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. So we're joined right now by Professor Michelle Chosadovsky, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. And we're discussing the topic of Cuba and the co-optation of Cuban intellectuals. So, Professor Chosadovsky, right in March of last year, you'd written an article addressing that specific point. I was wondering if you could maybe elaborate a little bit more on the threat you see there, because we've been there was. Supposedly a lot of good news when Barack Obama had gone in there and indicated that there was going to be a change in tack in terms of, how we approach the situation in Cuba. But I'm sure you would agree that this is not so much this normalization of relations between the two countries is not necessarily something that, people in solidarity with the Cuban the People's Movement and the Castro Revolution should feel good about?
Well, let me just put this in context. I think that certainly under the Trump administration, and he's made very firm declarations to that effect, that there is a regime change agenda which is currently contemplated by Washington policymakers. That's absolutely clear. And the Trump administration has been categorical. I don't think that this is necessarily different to what Obama would have done. Obama is just as much a figurehead as Trump. But, of course, Obama projects at least a vision of dialogue and exchange, which, of course, Trump doesn't have, particularly with regard to Cuba. And Trump, during his election campaign, had already committed himself to reversing Obama's policy directive, which was one of normalization. Now, let me put this in context. My distinct impression from my last visit to Cuba, which was 2 years ago, when I was invited by a think tank, research center associated with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to discuss and debate issues of transition. I think that what Washington is preparing is what I might describe as a soft coup. It comes from within. It's based on infiltration, co-optation. And there are various mechanisms which are already ongoing, the destabilization of the Cuban economy, its monetary system. Ultimately, the intent would be to eventually integrate the Cuban economy into the nexus of world capitalism, the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, and so on. And
that agenda is already ongoing, and it also has the support of people at in high levels, and specifically it also has the support of Cuban intellectuals. So we have to look at that background. Now, I had a very specific experience when I went to Cuba the last time. The previous time, I actually met with Fidel Castro and had and was invited to his home and had a long-standing conversation over a four-day period, which was subsequently published by Global Research. I should mention that Fidel was a reader of Global Research. That's how the invitation to meet him came about. He was a frequent reader of Global Research. Now, let me explain a little bit what happened. I was invited to a conference which was sponsored by the Center for Research on International Politics, CIPI, in Spanish, Centro de Investigaciones de Política Internacional. Now that, as I said, that research center was linked to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And the theme of the conference was to analyze the process of geopolitical transition, opened up by the resumption of diplomatic relations between Cuba and U.S. And, of course, it was during the Obama administration. It was in October 2015. Now, let me describe what happened. I accepted to come, and then a few weeks following my acceptance, I received a message from the Hans Seidel Foundation, informing me that they were supporting the conference and that they would be funding my expenses and they would also be paying me an honorarium. Now, when I got this invitation, having also worked very closely with people in Venezuela, and I at one time I lived in Venezuela, but I was familiar with the fact that the Hans Seidel Foundation, which is linked to the right-wing Bavarian Christian Democratic Party, was in 2012 involved in intervening in the Venezuelan presidential elections in support of Capriles Radonsky, who was running against Hugo Chavez. And they were involved in financing, the Venezuelan opposition. And at the same time, I recalled various other actions of this foundation in the Ukraine, following the collapse of the Soviet Union, but also in Chile, and I became deeply concerned by the fact that an entity linked up to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs would be funded by HSS, generously funded by HSS, because there were people coming from various countries. And the intent of HSS, acting on behalf of Bavaria CSU, which is a right-wing party, in liaison with the National Endowment for Democracy in Washington, is ultimately to undermine socialism in Cuba. And it is also consisted in an agenda of co-opting Cuban scholars and intellectuals, of course, paying them honoraria in U.S. dollars or in convertible currency. And that was the background.
They offered you an honorarium.
Yeah, well, they offered me an honorarium, and they also offered to pay for my expenses, my travel, my hotel, and so on. And I sent back a note that I would cover my expenses, which created some instability in the procedures. It wasn't expected, but I wasn't going to accept any honoraria from that kind of organization. And so I paid my own expenses, ultimately, what was more significant is the fact that the HSS was also, first of all, choosing the people who were coming to this conference, not all of them, but also it was also co-opting the Cuban scholars who were attending, all of which I presume had honoraria paid to them in one form or another. Now, what was really striking there is that, first of all, they invited people from a number of countries, including Canada, including the United States, from various countries in Latin America, Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, and so on. Not a single scholar was invited from Venezuela. Okay? That didn't surprise me, because the Hans Seidel Foundation would have said, well, invite our friends who are the dissidents, which are supported now by the National Endowment for Democracy. And probably the Cubans said, no, we have to invite the Chavistas, so that nobody was invited from Venezuela. There was a panel on Venezuela. Not a single Venezuelan was there.
Who was invited?
Pardon?
Who was it? Was there any notable invitations that did show up?
No, there were no Venezuelans invited to this venue. And bearing in mind that the relationship, the political relationship between Venezuela and Cuba is very significant in terms of, solidarity and so on, there was not a single Venezuelan invited. That was a decision of the German foundation, Hans Seidel Foundation. It was not a decision necessarily of the Cubans, but the Cubans accepted it ultimately. So that there we have a right-wing foundation determining the composition of who is invited, who is not invited. Now, I should say that among the Cubans, there's some very good presentations, okay? But then we had a number of rather unusual, I wasn't expecting this, at a venue by Socialist Cuba. They invited an Israeli guy who was with Chatham House in the UK. Now, anybody who knows Chatham House, Royal Institute of International Affairs, knows that this is really the right wing think tank, arch reactionary British think tank, with links to the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. And they invited Yossi Meckelberg, who came in and was discussing the Middle East. There was nobody from Syria. They could have invited people from Syria, from Palestine. No, they weren't. They invited an Israeli. And then the Israeli actually made his speech and provided a very biased interpretation of what was happening in Syria and Palestine. I won't get into the issue of the U.S.-led terrorist insurgency in Syria, but he said it's a civil war, and then he tagged Palestinians as terrorists, okay? He also said President Bashar al-Assad was accused of killing his own people, and, of course, much in line with U.S.-UK corporate media. That was not the position of the Cuban government, which expressed its solidarity with the Syrian people. And Meckelberg said that the ISS emulates the Palestinians, okay? And he says, and I'm quoting it, actually I'm quoting from another source, if at all ISS emulates the Palestinian militants, not the other way around, says Yossi Meckelberg, associate fellow at the London-based international affairs think tank Chatham House. That was the guy that the Cubans, invited. Well, they didn't invite it. It was imposed by this foundation in Germany, which was footing the bill of a rather expensive venue with people from various countries, including Africa. They came from Africa, the Middle East, and so on. And then you had a couple of scholars from the Peace Institute in Vienna, who were pushing their support for the Kiev regime, which is integrated by neo-Nazis. It was
Svoboda and the Right Sector, right?
That's right. It just so happens that the professor was invited from the Vienna-based Peace International Institute, who is also a member of the European Parliament. His name is Professor Hannes Svoboda. He came, and he outlined his support for U.S., NATO, and Eastern Europe, directed against Russia, as well as his endorsement of Ukraine's Maidan Kiev regime. Which we know, of course, as you mentioned, is integrated by two neo-Nazi parties.
Basically, you're saying that this conference, that this October 2015 conference, which you were invited to, that's it's being financed by this HSS, which, it seems kind of remarkable because this is supposed to be, where we go as far as Cuba moving forward and inviting all these different scholars. It sounds vaguely reminiscent of some of the points you raised about the World Social Forum, where the Ford Foundation was involved. Are we talking about the same kind of phenomenon when you talk about this co-optation? I guess in this instance, it would be of intellectuals. I think with World Social Forum, you're talking about co-opting movements.
The World Social Forum, it has a different structure. It really is based on a mosaic of workshops, and they say we must respect each other's point of view, but in effect, you might say that the same collective of corporate tax-free foundations is behind, which was behind the World Social Forum. We have the replicate here. I don't think that the Hans Seidel Foundation funds the World Social Forum. But the Ford Foundation does, or did at the outset, and there are various other key foundations which continue to fund the World Social Forum, and they belong to the same group. I mean, the Hans Seidel is one of the largest in Germany. There are others in Germany as well. The logic is the same, is to co-opt individuals and intellectuals. But you see, what was shocking in this is that when this Zionist participant invited by an institute affiliated to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs starts to bash the Palestinians and the Syrian government and the Syrian people, not a single word from the Cuban intellectuals who are there saying, "Well, listen." And then when the guy from the Peace Institute starts talking about Ukraine, they don't react, and they don't react. In fact, they don't react. And affirm that their government expressed solidarity with the people of Donbass and Crimea, okay? And in turn, the people of Donbass, the separatist province, acknowledged the solidarity with Cuba and the teachings of Fidel Castro. But the the participants in this conference did not have the guts to stand up and say, well, Professor Svoboda, you are an apologist of U.S. NATO-led wars in Eastern Europe, okay? Which is very, very, very obvious. Or stand up to the guy from Chatham House, the Zionist Israeli who came to tell them, to explain to them what's happening in the Middle East and tell them, well, listen. And I stood up. There's another person who had been invited. He was there, who was an Iranian, who was actually already in Cuba. He stood up and said, well, no, this doesn't make sense. But the thing is, there we had a debate on transition, and one had the distinct impression that some kind of new normal was being pushed in, a new consensus that somehow it was important to establish relations with Chatham House, with these institutes in Western Europe, which are linked up to U.S. NATO, and that was the tendency there. I raised this with a couple of friends at the time, and Cuban friends, and they weren't surprised because they said, "No, this kind of thing is happening."
Professor Chasudovsky, we don't have a lot of time. I know there's some restrictions on your time. I was wondering if you could just maybe explain why it is so important to co-opt intellectuals in particular. I mean, I know that there's been, I mean, usually when people think of regime change, they're thinking about military in interventions of some sort, or even co-opting as just like movements, you know, colored revolutions. Where does the intellectuals fit into that?
Well, the co-opting of intellectuals is very important because intellectuals are powerful voices which people listen to, okay? And if Cuban intellectuals start saying, well, we have to accommodate and we have to move forward and establish relations with the State of Israel, for instance, and we have to look into the possibility of restoring capitalism within certain, while preserving our societal projects, et cetera, et cetera. Well, this rings a bell. The people listen to intellectuals now, and we are also listen to intellectuals in North America now. We listen to Noam Chomsky. Well, Noam Chomsky was in favor of. Is in favor of regime change in Syria. That's his opinion. Mm. And the left, the so-called left in North America has taken a rather ambiguous stance with regard to events in Syria. You have another prominent intellectual in Britain, Tariq Ali, who makes the same statement with regard to Syria. So that ultimately foundations manage to twist progressives into saying things which ultimately are similar to what U.S. foreign policy pundits are saying. Okay, we must get rid of Bashar al-Assad. Well, if they say that, it's very powerful. So if a Cuban intellectual says, well, we should maybe have diplomatic relations with Israel, or we must interchange with. We must look into the issues of Palestine in a particular way. This has a bearing, and of course, ultimately, what is at stake is really will the Cuban social project, revolutionary project, survive? And I'm not very optimistic because. Ultimately, the whole monetary structure is very, very unstable with dual currencies. On that same visit, I met up with friends from the University of Havana, and they said to me, "We have shortage of paper. Paper is rationed in the classrooms." And publication of books is now at a standstill. So something, some very serious disruptions are occurring within the whole, economic system to make those things happen. The underfunding of universities, the underfunding of schools, something which didn't exist historically in Cuba. Inroads into the healthcare system, and so on, and eventually inroads into the system of consumer rationing, which would ultimately lead the Cubans into a situation of poverty and social inequality.
Okay. I know you've got to go almost right away, but I know that I just wanted to mention that you'll be speaking in Winnipeg on Monday the 15th on the North Korea crisis, and then in Vancouver on the 16th. And is there anything you'd like to – I mean, I'm just kind of curious to see if there's a quick comparison that could be made between Cuba and North Korea to, at least in terms of U.S. Designs.
Well, the objective of the United States in on the Korean Peninsula is twofold. One, it's to destroy socialism in North Korea. North Korea is a buffer state. It has borders with Russia and China. But the ultimate objective of the threats and the possibility of war with North Korea, the ultimate objective is China and Russia. It's the threat, as I said, the real threat is not, or let me put it differently, the objective of the geopolitical objective of Washington is not necessarily to destroy North Korea. It ultimately views North Korea as a stepping stone against China. That is, I think, something which is absolutely crucial. But if we start to compare North Korea to Cuba, the logic of socialism in North Korea is fundamentally different because they're completely cut off from the capitalist economy, and consequently they've been able to build their economy based on self-reliance. Cuba is in exactly the opposite situation. It is increasingly integrated into worldwide capitalism, and it has for many, many years. And at the same time, the fabric of Cuban society is currently in crisis, and there are large sectors, I think, of Cuban, particularly, and we mentioned intellectuals, which favor some kind of capitalist restoration. And in fact, it would appear that this capitalist restoration is almost de facto, despite the broad commitments that the Cubans have to sustaining the Cuban Revolution.
Professor Chossadovsky, I'll let you go now. I appreciate your time, and definitely look forward to these upcoming talks of yours. So, and enjoy the rest of your week.
Thank you very much.
That was Michel Chossadovsky, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. Professor Chossadovsky will be speaking to audiences in two Canadian cities about the situation in North Korea and the prospects of an escalation into a nuclear conflict. He speaks in Winnipeg on Monday, January 15th from 2:30 to 4 p.m. at 237 University College at the University of Manitoba. Then in the evening from 7 to 9 p.m., Professor Chossadovsky speaks at the University of Winnipeg's Eckhart Gramité Hall on the third floor of Centennial Hall, the main campus building. On Tuesday, January 16th, Professor Chossadovsky speaks in Vancouver Public Library Central Branch at 350 West Georgia Street, starting at 7 p.m. Admission is free for all three events, but donations are welcome. For details, visit globalresearch.ca. Arnold August will be speaking in Winnipeg's McNally Robinson Booksellers in the atrium on Thursday, January 18th, starting at 7 p.m. on the topic of Cuba-U.S. relations from Obama to Trump. Admission is free. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.